Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Davis Malm. Their tax lawyers are committed to your most taxing matters. Learn more at davismalm.com. That's DAVISMALM.com. Davis Malm. Lean. Agile. Strategic.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, there's dissent within the GOP with one Republican congressman backing those Democrats who want to impeach Trump, and a dissenting voice on Fox News with Pete Buttigieg using his town hall to call out Laura Ingraham and Tucker Carlson. On today's Politics Roundup, we talk about this, plus another blow to abortion rights coming out of Missouri and how this escalating culture war is shaping the 2020 race. In 2015, John Bolton wrote a New York Times op-ed entitled, "To Stop Iran's Bomb, Bomb Iran." Given Trump's latest tweet threatening Iran, is John Bolton winning the foreign policy war? We'll talk to Charlie Sennett about this and more.
Kamala Harris wants to punish companies that don't pay women equally. At noon, we open the lines and ask you if she's figured out how to close the gender pay gap. Then TV's Bob Thompson weighs in on the much-anticipated season grand finale of Game of Thrones. Did it live up to the hype or not? That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to hello to Boston Public Radio. Marjorie is busy talking, doesn't know it's her opportunity to say this is the beginning of the show. Thanks for being here.
Sorry.
He's Jim Browdy. I'm Marjorie Egan.
We're talking about something very important.
I didn't mean
Jim.
To bother you, though,
very
Marjorie.
Important.
What are you talking about, fashion?
Game of Thrones, actually.
Okay, fine. So do you want to start the show, which you're supposed to do at 11:06
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Sorry to bother you.
It's okay.
In a series of Saturday night tweets, President Trump weighed in on the abortion debates, writing, quote, "The radical left with late-term abortion and worse is imploding on this issue. But could it be the Republicans who implode if abortion dominates the 2020 election and dwarfs Trump's major asset, a booming economy?" Joining us to talk about this, dissent within the GOP, as a congressman from Michigan becomes the first Republican to support impeaching Trump. And other headlines are Jennifer Becerra and Steve Kerrigan. Jennifer's a political columnist, senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, and a former commissioner of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, Jim.
Steve Kerrigan is president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund, which we're going to talk about in a couple of minutes. Former CEO of the Democratic National Convention, and he ran for lieutenant governor, I'm sorry, a couple of years ago. Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. Can I get a copy of that intro? That was really nice. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, this is where you ask a question,
well, Jim just mentioned a Michigan Congressman Justin Amash having read the Mueller report saying that the president did things that deserving of impeachment. But he seems to be sort of an outlier. I don't know what to make of this, Jennifer Becerra. Tell me.
Yes, I think he is an outlier, at least at this juncture. And I've always said, you know, impeachment isn't really a plausible thing unless Republicans want it, and they go to the president and have the come to Jesus conversation like they did with Nixon. That's the only way it's ever really going to happen. I don't think it will move much beyond this.
You know, I think the most significant thing he tweeted to me, which I especially after Lindsey Graham's embarrassing admission at the beginning of that hearing a few weeks ago, I haven't read the whole Mueller report, when he said, and I'm paraphrasing, that he didn't believe that the majority of his colleagues in Congress have actually read this thing. I watch cable TV political shows obsessively, and whether you agree or disagree with the point of view, it is so clear to me that the vast majority of people who were speaking have not read the whole thing, which is a problem. Isn't
it's a
it?
Big problem. The vast majority probably haven't read that 4-page letter that Bill Barr did,
well, that
let alone the whole report.
But
it's what's amazing about this Justin Amash thing is that I don't think anyone of us in this room, maybe you all did, but I didn't know his name until the president started tweeting about
him.
So why the president takes the bait like this and starts tweeting about a guy who's, by the way, the chair of the Liberty Caucus in the House. He's not exactly a flaming liberal. Like this guy is a dyed-in-the-wool libertarian conservative, but a conservative who I'm assuming his branch of the party has a wing of people who are concerned somewhat about the president's activities like he is. But it to me is at least he read the whole report. At least he says he read the entire report. And Senator Romney apparently read the entire report. I will say, I'll freely admit, it's on my coffee table. I've read a lot of it, but not all of it. But for this guy to step up, I think it is courageous, is what Romney said yesterday. But I agree with Jennifer. Like it's It's like my friends on the Democratic side talking about impeachment when we know we're not going to win a vote in the Senate. So it really, to this point, as Nancy Pelosi has said many times, he's just not worth it.
Like we should be clear, by the way. Well, Romney did comment on it and said he was courageous.
Sure.
He said he disagreed with his conclusion
right.
about the obstruction thing. I would answer your question. I don't know if Jennifer feels any differently. The reason Trump took the bait, to use your expression, is because every time he tweets criticism of somebody, virtually everybody else in his party is scared into silence. I mean, it's hard it's hard for me to believe that Mitt Romney is the only person in the Senate who read the report and was as he said early on, and was troubled by some of the things he read. But most people aren't willing to incur the wrath of a president who's powerful in their home districts.
The president does it. I think that there's a much simpler explanation, and it's just
can't control himself.
It's just he just reacts. He just reacts.
So, Jennifer,
but by the way, just stay on this one second. So you don't think this is going to sort of loosen things up? John Dean, and I love when he's commenting on these things on CNN, said something I was unaware of till yesterday. He was asked by the host on one of the CNN shows, was there any precedent for this in the days of Watergate? And he said, actually, there was, Larry Hogan. And I'm guessing it's the same Hogan, because the congressman at that time was from Maryland.
Right.
And the
it's
governor
the governor's
is now,
father.
Oh, it's his father.
I'm sorry.
So. Okay. That he was the one outlier, not unlike this Michigan congressperson. He was the first, and the first for a while, according to Dean, at least. You don't think this opens anything up? You think it's at least for the time being one and done?
No. I mean, the polling shows that amongst Republicans, at least voters, 90% of Republicans are very happy with President Trump. So given those numbers, no, I don't think so.
You feel any differently?
I mean, until people start taking their oath of office as seriously as Congressman Amash do, then no, I don't think it's going to open anything up. Sadly. I wish it did.
So we always hear the line ever since Bill Clinton days, it's the economy stupid. But I wonder what you think is going to happen with all this new legislation about abortion. Is abortion going to become a big issue in 2020?
It's definitely going to be front and center because politicians will make it front and center. I don't know that voters, I'm not sure whether voters consider it a number one issue. What I do know is that the American people have been consistently split on the abortion issue, with about half considering themselves pro-life, half considering themselves pro-choice. And the
vast, I thought it was higher. I thought it was higher.
It is. Seven
pro-choice.
It's 7 in 10 to 8 in 10 who support legal access to abortion.
Not according to the Marist poll that came out last week.
You're both right. I read a lot of polling this weekend. While it is true that there is a roughly equal split on people saying they're pro-life or pro-choice, it is true that overall a significant chunk of people who are pro-life support legal access to abortion.
Yes.
So they're not inconsistent.
The way I would describe it is the vast majority of the American public believes abortion should be not banned but not on demand. That is where most people are. The vast majority do not want to see late-term abortions. They do not want to see sex-selected abortions. They do not want to see – so they support restrictions but not –
no, actually, well, I mean, the 7 in 10, now not all 7 of those 10 support full access to abortion.
No, most do not.
Not most do not. A few, 1 to 3 of those 7 in 10 support, all support legal access to abortion. Some support some restrictions. Almost no one supports a bill like Alabama or these heartbeat bills that are really designed to take all of the choice of a woman's ability to make her own healthcare decisions away from them, which abortion isn't just a healthcare procedure, although it is that. It's an economic decision, and a woman should not be forced. It is.
I think most Americans do not believe that an abortion in the case of economic decisions.
A woman should decide who when and under what circumstances to start a family. They shouldn't be forced by 25 white Republican men in Alabama to have to bring
a female governor.
They shouldn't be forced by anybody to start a family if they don't want to. This is their body and their choices. And that is a huge, by the way, economic impact on them down the road.
Well, that's one of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's best lines, that there is no economic freedom for women without reproductive freedom. And I think it was also interesting that she argued that this should have been a gender-based, gender discrimination-based argument instead of a privacy-based argument. But I was listening to my favorite podcast, The Daily, this morning, which kind of undercut my thinking that might matter, because The Daily Supreme Court reporter was arguing that it all comes down to politics, and even if it had been a gender-based decision in the first place, that where the judges are on this is going to matter more than whether you grant it for privacy reasons or gender.
Oh, I totally disagree. Yeah. I think the problem with, as you identify, the problem with Roe v. Wade is that it was based on the notion that Americans have this made-up right to privacy. I mean, we do have a right to privacy under state law and these other things. Let me finish. But Roe v. Wade is jurisprudentially unsound because it is tethered to a constitutional right to privacy, which is not in the Constitution. What Ginsburg has always argued is that the better argument would have been under the Equal Protection Clause,
14th
arguing
Amendment,
that this is an issue of disparate treatment. And she's right about that. I don't think that the justices are politically motivated. I do think they are very skeptical of the privacy arguments in Roe v. Wade. And I think had Ginsburg's perspective prevailed initially, I think that the decision would not be in danger today.
Look, and
Steve wanted to respond.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I just want to say Roe is the underlying law under which this is a decision this is based on. The Casey case from the 90s has a huge, which goes to a lot of the issues that you just talked about. I mean, the issue here right now, though, is that the drastic overreach by the Republican Party in Georgia, in Alabama, in Texas,
how about the drastic
in Missouri.
Overreach
let
in
me,
New York
let me finish.
And Virginia.
I let you finish. And let me finish. This is what I frankly think, to answer the initial question about whether or not this is going to be an issue in 2020. It was an issue in 2018 because of the Brett Kavanaugh hearings, and we saw a massive blue wave. I frankly think that people are frustrated and sick and tired of a system that allows Republican-led legislatures and governors to just sign into place bans on decisions that, frankly, have been done for 50 years in federal courts. And this is going to lead to, yes, it'll lead to a challenge. Yes, it'll end up at the court. I don't think it'll end up there before the 2020 elections. But I do think the political ramifications are going to be far worse for the Republican Party. And it's frankly, this is a tipping point. We're seeing it tomorrow all across the country. There are days of action in all 50 states. Hundreds of thousands of people are taking to the streets around the country to stand up for legal access to abortion.
And hundreds of thousands of people come to Washington every January
All 50 states. All 50 states are going to have people stepping up and stepping out, and that's going to lead to a big sea change in 2020.
Well, go ahead.
Look, my point is the country is divided on this, and what you have, they're both divided on it, and they are united in the sense that they want a compromise position. They don't want unfettered access to abortion on demand through the ninth month, and they do not want it to be illegal.
Let's just be very clear. Americans support legal access to abortion.
But
seven
not,
in ten.
Not
so it's not an equal divided issue.
No,
seven in ten no, support equal
no,
access
no,
to or legal access
on,
to abortion.
Hold on.
So
for
wait,
a second.
Let me say, as
okay,
far as the politics are concerned. Mm-hmm. So what we have seen recently in state legislatures. Are extreme bills on both the right and the left. You've seen extreme bills in Virginia and in New York that basically allow abortion through, you know, the day the child is born. And you've seen the governor of Virginia comment that it's okay to put the baby down after it's outside the womb.
Patently untrue. And the president saying that you could swaddle the baby and then murder it is absurd and only designed to stir up a crazy right wing.
Look, the bottom line is you've seen extreme legislation on the pro-choice side. You've seen extreme pro-life legislation. And the fact of the matter is the majority of the country doesn't want either of that. They want a middle ground approach.
But I also think I disagree that it's unfettered because I would find it hard to believe that anybody, including the physician, is going to abort a healthy fetus at 8 months or that any woman is going to do that.
Planned Parenthood does all the time.
Who?
It's just patently untrue.
They don't.
I've seen the videos.
Seen a video of an abortion of a baby just before birth?
You know, That partial birth abortion is different than an eight month fetus.
That's why they do it partial birth.
Oh my goodness, Jennifer, I can't believe you believe this because we have seen a lot of fake videos coming out of supposedly Planned Parenthood offices.
We've seen a lot of real ones. Have you seen the movie Unplanned?
No, I've not seen the movie Unplanned.
Then
you have a monstrous view.
Yes,
you do.
Yes.
Because
a
monstrous mother would abort a healthy fetus for no reason at 8 months. That's just beyond belief. But what the government wants to do is force women, the very rare cases where there is a fetal abnormality, that you probably read the story in the Globe about this, where at 28 weeks a woman discovers that she has a baby with no brain. It's rare. It almost never happens. That's what those nine-month bills are about, so you don't have to carry a baby that's going to die for 9 months. I don't think it's the government's business to tell me or to tell you or anybody else. I can make my own decision. That's the issue. Why should the government be involved at all? It says something horrible about these legislators' view of women and, frankly, their view of physicians.
I don't think it's about their view of women or their view of physicians. I think they just see the issue differently than you. And I think there's got to be a middle ground on this issue.
Then
this
why?
There is
then,
in Europe.
The middle ground
then
is keep your hands off a woman's uterus.
Excuse me. Let me just challenge you on one thing then. Then why the exception for rape and incest? If it's not about women, you know, what you're basically saying is if you're a victim, we'll let you get an abortion. That belies that it's really about babies, because there should be no exception for rape or incest if it's really about babies.
Well, like I said, I think there needs to be a middle ground. And of course, right, you can take the extreme position and say that anybody who's willing to compromise is undermining their own argument about whether it is or isn't a life. But, you know, look, as Sandra Day O'Connor said years ago, Roe v. Wade is on a collision course with technology. And the more we see of ultrasounds and the more we see of babies' heartbeats and the more we see learn about fetal development and we see babies who are being operated in the womb to have spina bifida fixed and then put back in, it's called fetal operations. The more we learn, the more medicine advances.
But the issue always comes down to who should decide.
Who should decide? That mother is deciding to have the spina bifida surgery.
Or does Donald Trump get to decide for me?
Donald Trump doesn't get to decide, but I think
he's appointing pro-life justices. Does Kavanaugh get to decide for me? That's the issue.
No, he's not appointing pro-life justices. He's appointing justices.
Well, yes, he is.
From the Federalist Society, you're all pro-life justices.
Well, I'm actually in the Federalist Society, so I can tell you that the Federalist Society takes no position on abortion. That although there are some people who
is that just so they can say they take no position on abortion?
Absolutely not.
Is there one member of the Federalist Society who is on a list for the Supreme Court that Donald Trump holds at his desk that is not pro-life?
I would argue yes.
We know the list.
Yes,
and there's
not
not one of them.
No,
I promise you,
we've
looked
totally
at every single one of them.
Well,
I'm
no,
on the
no,
National
no.
Board for NARAL.
Okay.
We have looked at every one of them, and every one of them is committed pro-choice or pro-life.
The problem is that the left conflates opposition to Roe v. Wade with being pro-life. And there are a lot of people who are pro-choice and believe in the right to abortion completely unfettered, but they do not believe that Roe v. Wade was rightly decided. And you can be pro-choice and be against Roe v. Wade.
By the way, speaking of the Federalist Society, just if I may break in for a second, we're talking to Jennifer Becerra and Steve Kerrigan. We're going to have Michael Kirk on tomorrow from Frontline, who has done a brilliant documentary about the Supreme Court. And a major focus, other than your favorite person, Mitch McConnell, Marjorie, is the birth of the Federalist Society in 81 and the power of the Federalist Society in 2019. Can we move on if you don't mind?
We're too exhausted.
Marjorie and I debated last week the whole advisability or lack of same of Senator Elizabeth Warren declining to do a Fox News town hall. She called the station a hate-for-profit racket. Well, Pete Buttigieg did do a Fox News town hall Sunday night, and he called out a couple of the network's primetime opinion hosts. Here's Buttigieg.
I mean, when you got Tucker Carlson saying that immigrants make America dirty, when you've got Laura Ingraham comparing detention centers with children in cages to summer camps, then there is a reason why anybody has to swallow hard and think twice before participating in this media ecosystem. But I also believe that even though some of those hosts are not always there in good faith, I think a lot of people tune into this network who do it in good faith.
By the way, former intern Buttigieg was of Steve Kerrigan, which is, thank you, Steve, one of the primary reasons we were able to get Buttigieg on our show, thanks to you. A lot of people in emails, and I think one or two who called the other day, said that's exactly what Warren should have done. She should have said yes and used the opportunity to do what Buttigieg did on the show.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I thought Pete used the opportunity incredibly well, not just to advance sort of why he is running for president, but to admonish that network, which, you know, Elizabeth has some good points, but the best way to deliver it is to those people who I agree with Pete, who watch in good faith, who, you know, may have a different perspective on politics or life, but that's where they go to get their news. And I, you know, I think on this show I said earlier in the summer, or the spring rather, that I disagreed with Tom Perez's decision not to have Democratic debates on Fox News. I just think any time, especially in such a divisive time in our nation's history, we need to be finding ways to talk to the other side and show them that we don't have horns and that we don't breathe fire, that we actually have ideas that go across the aisle and across our own kitchen tables to each other. And so that's why I think what Pete did was brilliant. I think he is continuing to run a really great, smart, strategic campaign where he talks from his heart, and I think that's going
to
connect.
You know, I didn't see the whole thing, but I did see the clip of the audience spontaneously hopping to their feet at the end of his performance, and Chris Wallace kind of looking startled and stunned.
Not unlike the Bernie Sanders, thing on Medicare for All.
Yeah, so it did say something about, you know, I thought that their audience would be much more hostile, both to Sanders and to Buttigieg, but they weren't.
No, I mean, look, I think that Elizabeth Warren made a huge mistake. And I think that if she gets the nomination, historians will look back on that statement as her deplorable moment.
I agree with that.
And you cannot look down your elitist nose at 50% of the country and call them haters and think that you were going to win a presidential election. I'm sorry. She's a smart woman, but that was a dumb mistake.
So the latest national poll that I saw last night has Joe Biden crushing everybody. Speaking of Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, roughly half the numbers, second place. A chunk behind Elizabeth Warren, just ahead of Pete Buttigieg in fourth place. Marjorie and I have had this debate probably every single day since Biden entered the race. Every time I cite the fact that I am stunned by how well Biden is doing this early, Marjorie's response is, Jim, it's early, it's early. My response is, when you have 23 people in a race, that kind of lead early is huge and has potential but it's much more meaningful than had it been a 3 or 4 person race. What do you make of the big Biden lead?
I think
this early, Steve Kerrigan.
I'm a big fan of the vice president's, I am probably as surprised as you are. And I thought he was going to come out of the gate in the position he was, sort of toggling between he and Bernie at the top. But he has continued, not just with the staff he has hired is incredibly diverse and really, really smart. And he didn't go small with the staff at the beginning. He went very big and big in the early states. His positioning of his campaign headquarters in Pennsylvania. I mean, all of the way he's doing his schedule, frankly, which is a slower schedule than he did as vice president, but it's more deliberative and he's allowed to focus his mind and his energy. I think he is running so far an almost flawless campaign in a few weeks, but it is really early. But your point is exactly right. I don't see more than 6 folks dropping out before, like, Labor Day. But I do see some folks possibly could be dropping out, particularly after these debates coming up in June and July. And then, you know, you're getting toward Iowa and New Hampshire. He is right now, with that lead, raising a ton of money and putting a lot of people on the ground in Iowa and New Hampshire.
You know,
and that's
before you respond to that, Jennifer, yeah, the other thing is, because he's so far ahead, every one of the other people has to say something critical of him.
Right.
Every time they do it, it just raises his profile as if this is the guy we're running against, as opposed to 24 others, which I think is good for him.
Yes.
Well, I think the large field favors Biden just as the large field in the Republican primary favored Trump in 2016 because you have people who are for Biden and then everyone else splitting their votes amongst these other people. And so you saw Donald Trump winning primaries with pluralities, not majorities, where, you know, the majority of Republican Party voters going into the convention had supported somebody other than Donald Trump. So, so what it does is the huge field favors the person with name recognition, celebrity status, you know, and an ability to reach the largest number of people, whether it's through a Twitter following or just because, you know, your Uncle Joe who used to be vice president. So it favors people who are media savvy and famous already.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you saw Meet the Press yesterday, even Bernie Sanders, who is number 2 in the polls, the entire interview was about Joe Biden.
Yeah.
And that had to have, it was his first time in a year going on Meet the Press. I can't imagine he's going to go back again for a while.
So are we discounting? A lot of people in the media got criticized for discounting Bernie Sanders, including us, the last time around. Are we discounting Sanders again, thinking he just can't win, so we're not going to give him the attention that we give to a...
I'm not discounting him because I think that Bernie Sanders actually... appeals to a lot of the same people, not all, but a sliver of the same people that Donald Trump appeals to. And so you saw in New Hampshire, for example, when Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, you know, both did really well unexpectedly, they were appealing to the anti-establishment voter who's just sick of the, you know, professional politician and feels that they haven't been heard. And they feel that both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump can speak for them. And so I don't discount him, because that sleeping giant of voter was awoken in the last election.
Yeah. So I would say this. I agree with everything Jennifer just said, which is fun for today. And but if you look at his numbers early in the process, in 2016, a lot of his victories were caucuses. And he knows how to organize a caucus. They weren't big primary votes, which Hillary did well in. And so if that's your base of support, which is smaller than primary voters, and it gets cut up by Elizabeth and others who are now ascribing to your beliefs, it's going to be harder for him this time. But I agree with Jennifer.
Yes,
don't discount it.
Okay, we're going over the latest headlines from the State House, the White House, with Jennifer Becerris and Steve Carrick. And we're going to keep talking about some local stuff and getting a little culture. When we come back, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking politics with political columnist Jennifer Becerris and Steve Kerrigan, who's president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund.
So this has to be one of the weirdest local stories in a long time. We have this casino going up over there in Everett, and it's been very controversial because of Steve Wynn's allegation that he raped somebody, all sorts of gruesome sexual harassment stories, whether they could keep the license. Well, they kept the license. Now, last minute, just weeks before they're going to open with all these jobs, Wynn Resorts and MGM Resorts are talking about possibly selling this Encore Boston Harbor Casino in Everett. It seems a little late. Game.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it doesn't. Steve and I were talking about this in the green room. It doesn't bother me. It's fine. It's
as long as they pay their $35 million fine, they can sell.
Right.
They can sell to anybody. But
if they're
using it as a way to get out of the fine, then that's
well.
That's
by the way, they
okay.
can't just sell to everybody. The gaming commission's got to approve this. Yeah. You can only own one casino.
Right.
I just have to say, we've invited the woman who was the new chair of the gaming commission. She said she couldn't come on until after, understandably, the decision was made on the suitability of Wynn Resorts of Encore. So I hope it seems to me that it's odd that these discussions are going on and the Gaming Commission was not informed during the hearing. I mean, just as a matter of courtesy to the regulators, this is huge.
And all the people who are looking forward to these good jobs with good benefits.
Well, that's the larger thing.
Wynn was famous for paying people well.
That's the larger thing.
Despite Mr. Wynn's malfeasance.
And you guys have had my good friend Mike McLaughlin on to talk about the impact this is going to
have.
Yeah,
from Everett.
He's awesome.
Council.
From Everett, yeah. And he and the people in Everett have been working tirelessly to get good jobs for these folks, and they're a really good job. So if it impacts that, I mean, perhaps this says to the legislature, let's look at the underlying legislation that created the Gaming Commission to put some of these protections in, that you have to have a disclosure if you're in discussions to sell moving forward. If those provisions aren't in now, they should be.
Right, but as long as there are no such rules,
right.
He was under no obligation
exactly.
to say anything.
But keep in mind, just so people at home understand, if there were a deal, MGM would have to sell. You can't own more than one casino. MGM would have to sell Springfield, which is some level of dislocation. There was a joint press release from the two heads of the two companies saying, don't worry, everything's fine, our commitment to the community, et cetera. But, I mean, saying that and doing it with this kind of radical shift is just – it's amazing to me. In any case, we're talking to Steve Kerrigan and Jennifer Becerris.
So I want to get back. Jennifer Becerris is, of course, Republican, but you were saying, I think, last time
I'm actually not. I'm an independent.
I'm sorry. Yeah. You're an independent. Okay.
I'm a conservative.
How can you switch?
Well, mainly just because in this state it doesn't make sense
okay.
to be in a party when this gives you more options in a primary. I live in Lori Trahan's district.
She wanted to vote for me.
And I wanted to. That was an open seat, and there were, you know, a lot of people running on the Democratic side, and I actually wanted to vote in that primary, so
okay.
I switched.
Okay, well, you're conservative then.
I am.
But you were talking about how Seth Moulton, the congressman from the North Shore, would be a formidable candidate during the break. Steve informed me he doesn't even have enough money to get into the debates.
He doesn't have enough donors yet. He needs 65,000
donors.
No, he's not
formidable in the primary because there are 100 people running, because he doesn't have name recognition for a lot of reasons. were he to miraculously be nominated, he would be Donald Trump.
Yeah,
that's
but,
my view.
But apparently, the Lawrence, the mayor of Lawrence, says he should get out of town. That would be Dan Rivera. He should get out of town. Shouldn't even be in the race. But I guess the question is
that's a pretty big deal, by the way. Now, admittedly, Dan Rivera is an Elizabeth Warren fan.
Yeah.
But it is very rare. I mean, Moulton represents Lawrence.
No, he doesn't.
No piece of it. Okay.
Right next door.
But that's odd within the Democratic Party. Is it not your big time Democrat to be? It's one thing to support your candidate. It's another for and he almost belittled. You know, he said something to the effect a junior congressman or that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, he Dan's a friend of mine, but I disagree with him. Look, we're the Democratic Party, and as Will Rogers said, you know, I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat, so this naturally leads to the 24 person field in a primary. But, you know, it'll give folks an opportunity. Seth has got a great story. He is a decorated war hero, a fact he did not disclose during his own campaign for Congress.
Most incredible story,
including to his parents. I know.
He's got a much different shtick, talking about foreign relations all the time, and going after the president.
Well, because he's been in Iraq when we fought Iranian soldiers on Iraqi soil. So, I mean, he understands that he brings a new perspective to this race. I'm excited by the diversity of our field. And I just think saying that he should get out of the way. I'd love to have a smaller field of Democrats, but I'm glad that we have a lot of people who are excited about the prospect of serving our country.
Why would you like to have a smaller field?
Just because it's easier to focus. But it is great that so many people are excited. What would be worse is if everyone said, oh, God, the presidency, never mind. I'm not going to go for that racket.
So here is two tweets, so I don't misquote Dan Rivera, the mayor of Lawrence. For adults in the party need to say there's no reason a junior U.S. rep from Salem, Massachusetts, Moulton, he doesn't say his name, should be running when the senior senator from Mass, Warren, has been for months, and he goes on to say, hey, Tom Perez, chair of the party, or whatever he is, head of the party. At what point does the party say something looking more like a circus than a primary? No way this is a good thing. Maybe call Speaker Pelosi to get some direction. this will end poorly, says Dan Rivera.
So, okay, now let's get to the most important thing that we want to talk about here. Jennifer Becerra, I understand you're a big Game of Thrones fan. What did you think of the finale?
I am. I'm in deep mourning today.
Don't spoil it for people who haven't seen it yet. Just give your general comments.
Why can't people just watch it?
Not spoil it.
I'm so sick of the spoiler thing.
Okay, forget it.
Yeah. Go ahead. Spoil it. If you don't want to listen, close your ears.
I give it a B+. I thought it was good.
Okay.
I think there was no way they were going to satisfy everybody or sort of resolve all the fan theories that were out there. But overall, I thought it was really good. And, you know, there were flaws with this season. It was only 6 episodes. It was too short. They tried to shove in huge plot turns, you know, in a very short time. But overall.
Jennifer, do me a favor. Say to Marjorie, what do you think of the final episode? Say that.
Marjorie, what do you think of the final episode?
Well, I had an embarrassing moment here.
Because
I have not watched Game of Thrones.
Okay,
I thought the last couple of weeks I would try to catch up.
Oh, wait, she wanted to catch up. Good. So what do you think of the final episode?
Well, I watched the next to last episode where she was...
Episode, we call
where, what's her name? The queen was on the dragon.
She watched the wrong episode, is what she said.
Oh, yes.
I thought it was a weird finale, I guess is what I thought.
So that's supposed to evoke the bombing of Dresden.
Is that what it's supposed to evoke?
That's what it was based on.
Wow. Well, it was pretty harrowing stuff, so I guess I'm going to have to watch the actual finale.
Well, I'll tell you what happened to me.
You watched 3 episodes more than I have. Yeah.
You think that's embarrassing? I intended to watch the last episode, and instead, by chance, I watched Curb Your Enthusiasm, and I didn't understand why Larry David was in it in a sports car. So
I intended to watch all the seasons and then didn't.
So on a much, much, much more serious and important note, describe what your organization is doing on Memorial Day.
This is our 10th or 11th year where the Mass Military Heroes Fund will join with hundreds of volunteers this Wednesday on the Boston Common, right at the foot of the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial, and we'll plant 237,293 flags in the soil. They'll stay there through Memorial Day. Each one of them represents a fallen service member from Massachusetts from the beginning of the Revolutionary War to this month. And on Thursday at 10:30, we'll be joined by a lot of our bereaved families and the governor and the mayor and others to read aloud the names of all those who've been lost in post 9/11 conflicts. It's a really powerful tribute. I encourage everybody to go by. We're a small, scrappy nonprofit, but we support a couple of hundred military families here in Massachusetts with everything from additional funeral costs to mortgage payments when times are tight, with grief counseling and community support. So we're a great organization. If you want to learn more about us or help us out, you can text FLAGS to 44321. That's FLAGS to 44321, and come down to the Common at any time between Wednesday and the following Monday and just experience this great flag garden.
By the way, either last year or the year before, I happened to be there. One of the most powerful sights I've ever seen. It is really something. Thanks for doing it. Good to see you both.
Yeah, thank you guys very much for coming in. Jennifer Becerris is political columnist, senior fellow, Game of Thrones enthusiast, and with the Independent Women's Forum, former commissioner of the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Steve Kerrigan is president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund, former CEO of the DNC. Thank you both for coming in, and good luck with Memorial Day. Steve, coming up, President Trump's merit-based immigration plan falls flat with Republicans and Democrats. Charlie Sennett joins for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. For a moment, it seemed like there was a role reverse on the West Wing. Donald Trump is playing the sober, level-headed adult in the room, trying to tamp down his war-crazy advisors on Iran. But did Trump's Sunday afternoon tweet betray who's winning the foreign policy fight? It was this: if Iran wants to fight, that will be the end of Iran. That's what the president tweeted. Joining us for his take on this and Britain's Brexit bungles and other global headlines, Charlie Sennett. Charlie's a news analyst here at GBH. He also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. Yeah,
well, hello, Charlie Sennett. Well, what is going
on? Quick thing on Memorial Day. I just wanted to say that the thing Steve was talking about is exciting. And on Memorial Day, we're going to be rebroadcasting the series we did, The 11th Hour with Brian O'Donovan, about the 100th anniversary of World War One, and Brian's, you know, unbelievable just expertise around the music and the poetry of that time. I hope we can, as people are honoring what Steve was talking about, that maybe they might also listen in. I think it's Sunday night. I believe it's at 8 p.m.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Charlie. So to get back to Iran, what is going on with Iran, and what is going on with their nuclear weapons?
Well, I mean, I think that another large question is what's going on with the United States in reaction to Iran? Like, where did this sudden tightening of tensions come from? Iran is a reckless theocracy that has long been a problem in the region and for the United States, and we're used to their behavior. Whether or not they really are responsible for these Saudi tankers and the UAE tanker that was sabotaged, according to the UAE at least, were sabotaged, it remains to be seen. There's a lot more information that needs to come out about that. There's a lot of skepticism about what's really going on and why are things ratcheting up and why is there, a naval carrier sort of taking a left turn into the Gulf at this time, what is happening here? But I think a question the world's asking is you have these two hawks, particularly on Iran, in the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and National Security Advisor John Bolton, who have for years had very high rhetoric about the need to bring Iran, into order and to really challenge them, and in the case of Bolton, to talk about regime change. And this is, again, it feels like here's the Trump administration again ratcheting up, sort of this very bellicose talk in a region that's very volatile. We've heard this in North Korea, and now we're hearing it in relation to Iran. And I was with some people over the weekend in Washington who do a lot of reporting on national security, and they were talking about this idea that, you know, the buzz in the embassies here in Washington, where I am today, is that America is becoming the boy who cries wolf. We keep talking about what we're going to do and sort of blustering, and we have a president who sends out tweets that sound ominous and bellicose, and then he gets distracted and moves on. But that is something that is going to undercut our security, undercut our position in the world. And I think there's a real need to step back and reflect on, like, how often are we going to let the rhetoric of this White House go on when it really can rattle the world?
You know, Charlie, that was a really useful explanation, but I just have one other hole to fill, at least for me. What are we looking for? What are we demanding of Iran? I don't quite understand.
Well, look, I think it's the perfect question, Jim, and I don't have the answer because I don't think we've been clear in articulating what we want from Iran. Remember, we had President Obama and Secretary of State John Kerry worked for many years on creating a deal with Iran that would bring their nuclear program under bay. It would definitely delay it for a very long time, and many felt like it would derail it. There were many people in the region who looked favorably upon that deal, but this president and this administration feels, as the president has called it, the worst deal ever, as he's called so many things, including the climate agreement. But what the alternative is, what they want to see happen, what they hope to achieve through sanctions that are hurting Iran but not crippling Iran, what kind of role the European Union should play in relationship to Iran, and what kind of pressure this administration wants to put on the regime of Putin in Russia, which seems to be very friendly to this administration, like what kind of leverage are they using with Russia on Iran? All huge questions left unanswered amid the chaos and the turmoil that they allowed to fester in the region because of this, I would call it reckless, really reckless rhetoric that's bellicose and over the top in a region that's volatile.
We're talking to Charlie Sander from the Ground Truth Project.
Charlie, we're reading a lot about, you know, more authoritarian, nationalist, populist leaders, Italy, France, the movement of Marie Le Pen, Hungary, so forth. Now we have Scott Morrison in Australia. Apparently, he did unexpectedly well. He's a very conservative, and he won when many people thought he was going to lose.
Yeah, surprising victory here. Really talking to what he calls the quiet Australians, which is like shades of Richard Nixon and the silent majority. And really interesting, you're right, there's this global phenomenon. You know, the countries you mentioned, but also Brazil with Bolsonaro.
Yeah.
The Philippines, we have Duterte. In Egypt, we have El-Sisi. This kind of rise of populist nationalism is really alive and well. We see it in the Brexit debate. We see it, as you said, in France and the demonstrations in the streets. And I do think Morrison is an example of that. This is anti-immigrant. This is about Australia first, if you will. And he's echoing a lot of what President Trump said with great success in the elections in our country. And he is, interestingly, also in Australia, he's an evangelical Christian. And he's got always had this kind of deep admiration for President Trump, and it comes at a time of real tension in the Asia-Pacific region, and I think it's a very interesting development, a surprising one and interesting.
How is this missed, do you know? I mean, he himself had the something or other to call it a miracle, meaning he was not suggesting I knew it all along. Is this just because this percolates under the surface in certain places and people aren't willing to acknowledge where their hearts are?
Yeah, I think this is very much the way we all woke up, very surprised on the morning that Hillary Clinton lost and Donald Trump won the White House. I think Australia is waking up to a new reality in its own country that, you know, he's replacing a conservative government, so it's not like a dramatic veering away from the direction they were headed. But I do think there's an underlying sense that there's a global economy that is leaving many people behind. And I think there are many people in Australia who feel that and sense that. And this populist nationalism, as expressed by Morrison in Australia, it really connects with fear. And fear sells at a time of great change and uncertainty. And I think that's what I would say sort of ripples through the world in these places where we're seeing the rise of populist nationalism.
You know, Charlie, Marjorie and I have known each other 20 years, and she knows my favorite saying is, if at first you don't succeed, try four more times and then resign. That's been my, which apparently is exactly what Theresa May is doing. I mean, she's putting this thing up for a vote. This has no chance of carrying the day in Parliament, does it or does it? On Brexit.
No, it, Brexit is really dead in the water for now. And you're right, there was an incredible weekend of finger pointing by both main political parties, the Labour Party and the Conservatives in the UK, blaming each other for this deadlock and this sense that they just can't go forward. And meanwhile, this thing's becoming, it's like much more akin to Monty Python at this point than anything else. It's becoming absurd. Like, if you listen to the House of Commons and the calls for order and the disruption, and, you know, I can't help, I've said this before to the audience, but I really believe this. I can't help but see Putin smiling every time the UK descends into this dysfunctional finger pointing and blame. And we know that the Russians also interfered in this election with Brexit. This is a game plan underway, whether we want to see it or not, about an attempt to really divide Western democracies, to get them to turn against each other, to get leading parties to turn against each other. We see it time and time again. We're now seeing it in Australia. We see it in our own country. We see it in Brexit. It's really a great challenge we all face, no matter where you come from politically, whether that's from the left or the right, whether you're a Democrat or Republican, whether you're Tory or Labor. Russia's influence and its role in trying to sow division through cyber attacks and through direct misinformation and disinformation campaigns is a really big deal, and it is shaping our global politics, and we should be much more attentive to it than we are. And why aren't we hearing our White House, our Secretary of State in the United States talking about this issue and what they're going to do to protect our next election? I mean, you hear a little bit, but it is muted compared to the fear they keep peddling around the issues of immigration, or the fear they want to peddle about those who feel left behind by this economy.
Now, I know you're dreading the prospect that I'm going to ask you, why don't they have a second referendum? But I'm not going to ask you for once. What I will ask you is, she's going to be gone soon, yes? And so
that's what all the papers today are saying. It's over. It's wiped
so
out.
So what happens?
We'll see her.
What happens next on this, and with whom?
Well, there would be, some kind of snap election. There would be a reshuffling of the government. And there will be an early June wait until we really know where this is going to all come out. And I think that's when we're going to have to see where this thing goes. I mean, I've stopped guessing. This takes a different turn, like, literally every week. For the past 6 weeks, we've watched both Theresa May and Corbyn as the head of the Labour Party in these cross-party talks that have gone nowhere. They're now deadlocked. It feels doomed, and it feels like they're going to pull the plug on this thing, and they're just going to have to go into a reformation of a government and a new election. She'll have to step down. And I think everything is on hold until that happens.
Just one digression for a second before we get to the last topic with you. I'm just, as you're speaking, I'm looking at CNN, and I have to say, one of the most joyous things I've seen, even though it highlights the underside of the grotesque student debt in this country, kid from Morehouse, the graduates in 2019, who's been interviewed since Robert Smith said, I'm covering all your student loans to the tune of, what, $40 million, whatever it is, the smiles on the faces of these young men who are thinking they're leaving college with whatever kind of debt that's going to change their lives, the career path and that sort of thing. It is just, it's you know, even though it's one small little thing, it's to watch them is beautiful, but it does highlight the need.
2018 is really bummed out about this.
Or what if you paid off your loans in advance? Yeah. In any case, Charlie.
Well, as a father with three kids with college tuitions right now, I am so happy for those families. It's a dream come true for everyone in the country. It's so struggling with college debt. It's ridiculous where we are. So nice to see a little light of hope there.
Yeah, and some beautiful smiles, as they say. We're talking to Charlie Sennett.
So Charlie Sennett, should we take very seriously Secretary of State Pompeo's warnings to President Putin about Russian interference in 2020, right before he talks about getting together and having a greater relationship between Russia and the United States? What do we make of this?
I don't make much of it because, you know, we hear him say very little in the public comments that were made in Sochi when he sat directly there, and they weren't really talking about anything more than the vague, we need to protect our interests, and then quickly pivoting to how warm the relations can be, that we can be cooperative and productive. And, you know, President Trump wants to do everything we can and has asked me to travel here to do that. I still hear the same tone of an apologist regime to Putin. Like, what is going on with that? When you're talking about saber rattling with Iran and you think about how much Russia supports Iran and the many things that we see them doing around the world, which are against our interests, when you see Russia camp, you know, interfering with elections, not only in our own country, but as I just said, in Brexit and elsewhere, how is it that you can just continue to play footsie with this regime under Putin, knowing what they are responsible for? I don't understand it. I know when he met with Lavrov, when Pompeo met with Lavrov, they did talk more directly about the elections, but there's a lot of pressure we should be putting on Russia rather than this sort of, you know, we kind of do like a head fake and then we go back, and then we don't seem to have any clear or concerted policy in our relationship to Russia. And it's worrisome. And I think when we're coming up next month, there will be the G20 summit where Trump will, or at least is expected to meet with Putin. You know, where's the tough talk? This is a president full of bluster, a president who presents himself as a strong man, who has all this, you know, bold courage when it comes to issues like immigrants at our border. But where is he in directly confronting Putin and directly confronting the damage that Russia has done in the world?
Yeah, you just reminded me. Do we yet know what happened? Or is it Helsinki? Do we have any idea?
No, we don't.
What these two guys discussed? The answer, of course, is no. Hey, Charlie, thank you from wherever you are. Some bunker, it sounds like, but it's great to talk.
I'm sorry, is it a bad
No, it's not
underwater.
Bad.
Underwater.
You just have offices here.
We're glad to have you. Charlie, it's good to talk to you.
Charlie, thank you very much.
Okay.
Charlie Sennett joins us every week. He's a news analyst here at WGBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Charlie Sennett, thanks again. Up next, we're opening the lines and asking you about Kamala Harris' answer to the gender pay gap. That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, as Kamala Harris figured out how to close the gender gap. She's proposing the companies pay women on an equal basis with their male counterparts, and if they don't, they get slapped with a government fine. In a couple of minutes, we'll open the lines and ask you if this is what it would take to create gender equity in the workplace. Then TV Bob Thompson joins us to bid farewell to Big Bang Theory, Game of Thrones, and the world's favorite sourpuss. No, not me, Grumpy Cat, the feline phenom who dominated the internet.
Oh, we miss him already. Not in the mood for a chatty driver? Uber is now giving us the option to avoid small talk during their ride. We'll talk to tech writer Andy Notko about this, then open the lines and ask you if being able to opt out of human interaction is making us less human. We wrap things up with John Waters, whose latest book, Mr. Know-It-All, dispenses advice on how to be an irreverent force for good. All that is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So yesterday, presidential hopeful and U.S. Senator from California, Kamala Harris, called out gender inequities. And she wasn't talking about the war being waged on abortion rights, but the war on wages.
In America today, women for the same work, for the equal work, on average make 80 cents on the dollar. Black women make 61 cents on the dollar. Latinas make 53 cents on the dollar. And this has got to end.
So Harris did lay out her plan to end it, and what she's describing is the first ever national priority to close gender pay gap. She wants to turn the current system, I guess you'd say, on its head. Instead of requiring female employees to come forward with complaints, her plan would require companies to submit data each year on equal pay to comply with new standards. The companies which fail to comply with these standards would be slapped with a government fine. We're taking your calls asking you, is this what it would take to close the pay gap? Is it about time the burden no longer falls on the female worker, but on employers? Are you someone who's had to come forward and call out your employer for unequal pay? And how about you employers out there? What do you think about the Kamala Harris plan? Our number is 877-301-8897. You know what I also liked that was part of this plan is not getting as much play?
What?
Whenever anybody announces something bold that their law they're going to change when they're elected president, you say to yourself, yeah, but that's probably not going to pass. And what she went on to say is it might not pass. And she said, if Congress failed to act, I'm reading from the New York Times, Ms. Harris would apply these standards to federal contractors unilaterally, which a president can do, barring companies that fail to obtain an equal pay certification, which is what this annual thing would be, from competing for federal contracts at all, contracts valued at more than $500,000. I think it's great. I'm so sick of the studies and the reporting. And we're going to get a lot of data from these companies with either voluntary or forced compliance. What are you going to do about it? And I listen, I think the way around these fines, for those who think government shouldn't be involved in this business, it's big government, is pay people equal money. And that's all you have to do. If you pay them equally for the same work, then you don't have to worry about being fined. And if you don't, as far as I'm concerned, you should be fine. I think this is great. I don't know all the details, obviously, but I love the concept. Oh, okay. Good talking to you. 877-301-8897.
I'm not as sure
about it as you. Well, why don't you share that with us?
Because I just think it's a hard thing to do because I think that I'm a big believer in merit pay, and I absolutely agree with you that women are getting the shaft, and particularly women of color getting the shaft. But I get a little nervous when we want to start micromanaging how much everybody gets when you're not in a union. I think there should be merit pays within a union. I know you don't like that idea. But I'm concerned about it. I'm also concerned about women being able to step off track for the so-called mommy track, which I know that is a derogatory term, but there are women who want to be able to work a little bit less. And
How is that inhibited by her legislation?
Because if you have the same job and somebody's willing to work 70 hours a week, thinking it particularly in professional organizations, and another person has the same job and they want to say, listen, you know what? I've got three kids. I want to be able to have a more reasonable work life. I want to work 40 hours a week. You get into these very nebulous areas. I think it's really hard to do this with people who are, because it interferes with being able to give someone a raise who's saying,
who wants to work like a dog two times. Well, you know, my attitude about these things, this is where you and I part ways almost always on government action. I often want government involvement earlier than you do, but the one place where I'm amazed that you don't always agree with me is when it is clear the private sector has failed miserably
at
policing itself.
It is clear.
Then the answer is that's why you have government. Work out the details about merit pay, whatever it is. This is never going to fix itself. When you have elected leaders patting themselves on the back, which we hear almost constantly. Oh, we just passed new regulations it's going to require these companies to report this data. To what end? What's the enforcement? And by the way, they should go further. I wrote a piece for the Globe magazine a few years ago talking about boards of directors. You know that Boston Club survey that comes out every year about how few women are in C-suites and on boards? My favorite expression I think they create is a 0-0. A 0-0 is a publicly traded corporation. These are the biggest ones in Massachusetts. Don't have one woman on the board or one woman in a C-suite. There are a lot of countries in Western Europe, Spain, France, Italy, and some others that mandate that a certain member, certain percentage of the members of your board must be women, or you may not do business in that state. You either got to get one, either has to get serious about pay and gender representation discrimination or not. And I think Kamala Harris, despite your concerns, which some of which are legitimate, I think she is stepping up to the plate, which we all should do. 877-301-8970.
You know,
so the question is, what do you think about her plan for there to be government involvement? Companies have to get certified every year that there's equal pay. If not, they will be fined. And if they're a federal contractor, even if there's no law, she'll bar companies from bidding for federal contracts worth more than $500,000 if they are not, quote, equal pay certified.
I also think that the thing that resonates with people much more than that is child care costs. And I think that is a huge issue. And the Warren proposal to have child care costs to be no more than 7% of your salary, I think, is a huge thing. And this is fine, I guess. I don't have the same enthusiasm for it, obviously.
It is fabulous.
As you do. And I don't like quite so much micromanaging of
salaries. So if you don't, and you don't have the same level of enthusiasm, you don't like micromanaging,
I think it's like mothers
what
against,
is your plan
I think it's
to
like
get
mothers,
a,
I think it's like mothers against drunk driving.
Pay?
It's the same thing. It's great reporters pointing out, one of the great expressions of the year, too, is instead of calling a panel with four men on it? A mantle.
That is great. That is a great
I
one,
love that.
Actually. I love
it's
that.
It's great
too.
Reporting, pointing out that these terrible discrepancies, that there aren't enough women
what
in C-suite.
And what are we doing about it? Had black women 61 cents, white women 80 cents on the dollar, Latinas 53 cents. Your grandchildren will be long dead by the time there's equity.
I don't think so. I think there's more women in power. I think there's more push on these kinds of things. I think there's more knowledge about these kinds of things. I'd rather have it be like a mothers against drunk driving, change the culture.
Boston Club puts out the reports every single year to their credit about, again, the women in leadership positions in the 100, I think it's the 100 biggest companies which do business in Massachusetts. There's no change. Year after year after year, there's virtually no change.
Well, I wonder if there's something uniquely Neanderthal about Boston, because when you hear that not only is there no change in these C-suites, but you hear that we've only got 15, how many women on the fire department? 15?
15?
And there's 15. Like 1,500 firefighters. And you look at that, you think, oh my God. Or you look at the police department, or you look at the fact that there's that the city of Boston, which is supposed to be very aware of these things, when you look at the numbers, they've awarded almost no contracts in the
1%
city to women-owned and minority-owned companies. So it's terrible. I think we may be uniquely terrible in Boston, but I'm just not sure that, you know, micromanaging paperworking up these businesses.
Can I tell you, it's one place where I agree with you. That whole thing, you know, the thing you just mentioned, the story about only 1% of the city contracts out of 664 million go to people of color and minority and women-owned firms. My view is, rather than micromanaging, if we wait 300 or 400 years, there'll be equality.
My
in that.
View
there'll
is, be... you say to Marty Walsh, "What's going on? We're going to have a chance
I'm
to say that
at
to
7
Marty Walsh.
O'clock
why
tonight.
Aren't you? Why are you not doing this?" And you know, I think it's interesting. Boston was so slow, and Massachusetts was so slow to even elect anybody statewide until Martha Coakley came along. Whenever it was the first time around,
so you don't think
was it
be...
Shannon O'Brien? Maybe she was.
Well, actually, Evelyn Murphy, but she was teamed with Michael Dukakis.
She was not on her own.
Yeah, she was not.
Yeah,
on her
so
own.
Maybe it, maybe it's the Irish, Jim.
So wait a second. So
I'm
is
Irish.
Your view? There's no role for government in this thing except to require reporting.
Well, I don't like her idea that you're going to have to pay, you're going to have to meet these certification standards. If you don't, you're going to get fined 1% of your profit for every 1% difference in pay between men and women.
What's wrong with that?
I'm just not sure it's the way to go. I don't like.
But what's your way?
I just told you.
Just education.
Public shaming, a change in culture.
Yeah,
we managed
well.
To change culture about lots of things, and Mothers Against Drunk Driving is a great one. Smoking is another one.
Do you know that there were dramatic law changes around drunk driving at the same time that Mothers Against Drunk Driving is doing public education? We talked about it last week.
Yes, because...
Melanie's Law.
Because once again, people realized these terrible
But you don't
sentencing.
Want any law changes. You just said that. You don't want government involved. It's not just public education
well,
on drunk driving.
Well,
it's public
with all
education
due respect,
and laws.
I think running somebody over with a car when you're drunk and killing them is a little bit different. I mean, that's an obvious area for law enforcement. I'm not sure that this is an area where we need quite this micromanaging.
Okay, 877.
I'm more of a libertarian on some of these things than you,
877-301-897. I'm more an egalitarian than you on some of these things. Where do you want to go first? I slipped that in there. I was very proud of myself. I didn't think she was listening because you haven't listened to half the show so far. So I figured if I could slip that in, you wouldn't say anything and then go.
Laura from Andover, what do you think, Laura?
Hi, Laura.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
I'm really interested in sort of a middle path here.
What's that?
That there is certification available, but it's through an organization called Gender Equity Reconciliation. You can find the website at genderreconciliationinternational.org. And what they work on is teaching men and women to listen to and speak from the heart to one another, to get each other on the same page. Because as long as there's a battle between men and women, we're not going to get where we want to go.
So assuming that, and I'm not against anything that gets us there, but let's assume the heart-to-heart or whatever you just described doesn't get us there.
Yeah.
What do you do next?
I think that legislation is probably is better than nothing, but it still leaves us at odds with each other.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think you have to change the culture. I'm glad you said what you said. I think you have to change the culture and you need to legislate. Laws alone aren't going to change people's minds, but at least they will hopefully change their behaviors. Laura, thank you very much for the call. 877-301-8970.
Elvira in the car. Thank you for calling, Elvira.
Hey, Elvira.
Hi. I have to come down with Jim very strongly on this. The rest of it, I think, sounds very good. But I don't think it's effective enough and as quick as we need it to be. And really what I think is that we have to get away from this concept that we seem to have, that we fall into, that whenever there is public legislation, it must immediately, at its outset, be perfect. And legislation just normally doesn't. I mean, it starts the conversation, we get something on the law, maybe it's too restrictive, maybe it's not restrictive enough, but it really forces dialogue to get it through the two houses of Congress. It brings it to people's attention. And then once it's in, like Obamacare, for example.
That's a perfect example.
You need to open it up. You need to talk about it. And you need to make changes and not insist that we cover every negative. Culture change is great, but, you know, it's been a long time, guys. And it takes a long time to make culture change. Outside organizations are wonderful and can be a great big help to getting this done. But, man, I mean, it's all about money. And if these corporations find that they are not making as much money and they have to explain to their shareholders why they're paying these high fines, they're going to respond in one way or another. And I think it's long past overdue, and I'm willing to risk letting government, you know, I hate to start a whole new bureaucratic mess, but I'm willing to risk it to push this thing forward because I think there will be such a groundswell of support that they'll be forced to put something into place.
Elvira, thank you for your thoughts. We really appreciate it. 877-301-8970. I wish I'd said what she said.
No,
perfection
is
you do the best you can with the original legislation. Every decent and important piece of legislation probably ever has had to be amended once they realize that there are some unintended consequences of good ideas. And this is a good idea. And again, even if you're a Marjorie's libertarian kind of self, which is totally fine, you can't continue being a libertarian when the free market, when public persuasion doesn't get you from here to there, and there's gross inequity, which is what there is. I mean, that's what there needed to be laws, even though obviously, as we've learned, some of them are ignored around racial discrimination. There are a lot of laws at the same time that we try to do a public education, cultural mindset kind of change. Those things can go hand in hand, but that's why you have government. You have government to attempt to fix things when people can't fix them themselves.
Jennifer in the car, thank you for calling.
Hi. Hello, Jennifer.
Hello. Oh. Hi. I'm sorry.
That's okay. You're on.
I was listening to it. Okay. I want to thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to say that I think that Kamala has some really good ideas. I like this idea very much. If women were to get equal pay, then they could pay for the child's daily needs. And although that is expensive and sometimes keeps women out of work, if they were to receive equal pay, then they would be able to take care of the child care needs better than they could now.
Are you, I'm listening. I don't know why when Jennifer just said when she said that if they had equal pay, and thank you for your call, Jennifer, is it unbelievable that there is this kind of, forget the solution, this lingering disparity, again, this is according to Kamala Harris, and I think this is right, women for the same work, for the equal work on average, I said white women, it's not. It's all women, 80 cents on the dollar, black women, 61 cents on the dollar, and Latinas make half as much as a man does doing the same job in 2019.
I know. I told you 20 years ago, my bosses took me out to lunch when I was at the Boston Herald. And
that's
I was,
a great story.
And, they offered me a $20,000 raise, and I was making like about $60,000.
But explain why.
Well, I'm going to explain that in a second. And I'm thinking, why are they offering me a $20,000 raise? They want me to write four columns a week? I said, I don't have time. I didn't know what it was. And then I found out that a woman who had been at the State House sued the Boston Herald for unequal pay. And lo and behold, I was the lowest paid columnist in the newspaper. So they decided they better give me a $20,000 raise. So, I mean,
weren't
I was...
Weren't you worried you were going to get fired at that lunch?
I thought they were going to fire me. I thought, why am I boss taking me out to lunch? They're trying to let me down easy. What have I done? Did I make a mistake? Oh, my God. And it was because of this... this lawsuit, which is not what they told me, but I soon found out that was the reason. So, you know, I was getting screwed by major money. So I get the problem. I mean, it's a real problem, and it's terrible. But again, I'm just not sure this is the way to do it.
But look what had to happen to get you
somebody
have a
sued.
Huge someone had to sue.
That's right.
And what Kamala Harris does, in my opinion, brilliantly and simply here, is she flips the burden from individual women workers or collective women workers, if they have a union or they're going to file a joint, you know, some sort of class action thing, and flips the burden to the company. The company has got to certify that they have equal pay. If they certify it, then there's no harm at all to them financially. In fact, one would argue they benefit from the equal pay thing. If there's not equal pay, then they got to pay a price for it. It's so neat and simple. I really, and I'm amazed that it hasn't been broached before. At least I don't know that it's been broached before.
James from Abington. What do you think, James?
Hello, James.
Hi, Marjorie. Hey, Jim. Long-time caller. I'm sorry. Long-time listener, first-time caller.
Oh, thank you.
For both.
So my opinion of this, I'm not sure if anyone's brought this up before. I kind of joined in late. I'd like to see somebody address the underlying reason that people are able to get away with unequal pay. You know, if you have you have companies that are forced to publish internally what people make, and currently, like, it's a very big taboo. But Marjorie, you know, if you were able to look up what all of your coworkers made at the Herald, do you think you would have been able to be taken advantage of by being paid 20,000-30,000 less?
Well, that's exactly
great
true.
Point.
I mean, some people's salaries
I'd
were
like
hidden.
To,
Yeah,
I'd like to see, you know, maybe not published publicly, but I'd like to see companies forced before they're fined to publish all employee salaries internally. You can look up what, you know, Joe across the hall, what Jane down in HR, what they're all making, and, you know, that way you're able to see, hey, I'm being paid fairly, or you're able to really quickly address and have those awkward conversations with HR. Why isn't this happening?
You know, James, that's another approach to this, too. I know that probably some people are a little squeamish about that, but I agree that would have a radical impact on companies' policies pretty quickly. James, thank you for your first call. We'll hope you do another one soon.
Here's Steve, who says equal pay for women is a long-term inequity. Fixing it will require boards of directors to look beyond the next quarter, something they are not capable of doing. So Harris' approach is the only thing that will work.
Well, everything else has failed. I mean, that is exactly right. Everything
Linda
else
says
has
they
failed.
Do this in Iceland. Did not know that.
What do you mean? Are they a fining thing?
No, equal pay.
Oh.
Equal pay. They're big on legislation to guarantee equal pay.
So you're going to criticize Iceland?
No, they're a little different
really,
than us.
I'm stunned that you have this. I understand that you think there's some, you know, fine-tuning that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. You either take Elvira's position, which is get the thing in place and fix it later, or you work on the language like people work on the language of everything and try to fine-tune it in advance so that, you know, look at the marijuana law. By the way, there were a lot of problems with that, too. You voted for that thing, didn't you?
I did.
Okay, it was imperfect. They're attempting to fix it. There's still some problems. That's the nature of things that are game-changing, and this would be game-changing. We're talking about Kamala Harris's announcement that she would require companies to publicly certify that they do equal pay. If they do not, they would be fined 1% of their profits for every 1% difference in pay between men and women. And she goes on to say, which I really like, that if Congress fails to act, which it probably would, she would apply the standards unilaterally, which a president can do, to federal contractors, barring companies that from any bidding for any contracts of more than $500,000 if they do not have equal pay certification, as it's called. Let's go to Tom in a car. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi.
I support Kamala in part. I think it's a good idea. I just wonder about the punitive approach in everything. I mean, I'm a strong believer in regulation of business. But, I mean, nobody likes being punished. People like incentives. So make an incentive for people to, you know, follow the laws, whether it's in pollution or whatever. Make it worth their while to, you know, follow these concepts rather than, you know, get defensive and go to court and be fighting. You know, I think it just, for so many things that we need to work on in this country, it always seems like the punitive approach tends to be counterproductive sometimes.
Well, you know, but in essence, I'm not quarreling with your point, Tom, by punishing one company that is not equal pay certified, you are de facto rewarding their competitor who is or which is equal pay certified, right? Because they're able to keep all their profit.
I don't disagree. I'm just thinking, you know, businessmen tend to, and businesswomen, you know, tend to look at what's in their self-interest and what will they gain. And I think it's just a question of the mindset.
I understand.
If there's something, they can get a tax, you know, suppose they get a tax refund for, you know, upholding this. It's just a question of what's going to motivate people. And I tend to think that sometimes, unlike the National Security Advisor, who only believes in sticks and no carrots, I think sometimes you need a carrot.
That's an interesting point. Tom, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You changing your mind yet or not?
Not yet, but the people are making very excellent points. Let's go on to David in Arlington. Hi, David.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Back to the analogy with Mothers Against Drunk Driving, shaming people into not drinking and driving, combined with the laws that came out. And Marjorie, I feel like we're ganging up on you, but
it's okay.
Your comment was you agreed with the laws because drunk driving kills people. And I would argue that when women are not paid enough, I don't want to say it's going to kill people, but it damages their families. They can't pay for food for their family, for housing, for childcare, because they're not being paid equitably. And I also would say, as far as the last caller saying, you know, give it a carrot, using the carrot instead of the stick, it's kind of like giving everybody a trophy when they win. Oh, you paid everybody well? Well, then we'll give you a tax break. I think money talks in these cases. And you can talk about shaming businesses, but in the end, if you tell them that they're going to pay out of their pocket for not following the law, they're going to start following the law and start paying their employees equitably.
David, thank you for your call. I mean, you and I are both into negative, I don't know what the next word is, in certain settings. I mean, you and I think, and we've had this discussion with prosecutors and people like that, you put executives into orange jumpsuits.
That's
around
right.
2008.
I'm ready to do that.
And there, no, I'm serious. And there'd be a real incentive for the next. I know what we discussed it recently in the context of that the INSIS convictions.
They're facing 20 years in prison.
Right,
the
they're going to jail. That's a lot more powerful than a fine for
Absolutely.
Your company. Is the five executives themselves, former executives, including the head of the company.
Yeah.
For that bribing doctors and whatever else they did, that recent conviction, I guess a month ago, several weeks ago, I think that has a huge impact on the behavior of similarly situated people because they don't want to have their liberty taken away. In any case, I give her credit for raising the discussion, and I hope people start debating this thing. Kamala Harris, that is.
Okay, coming up, we are going to talk about TV. Bob Thompson joins us for his take on Game of Thrones season finale and a lot of other great stuff on the Tube. He's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Even though grumpy cats seem to have barely won life, dying at only 7 years old, she clearly lived nine lives as a celebrity when you factor in the average lifespan of internet stardom.
Grumpy was the spokes cat for Frisky's cat food. She had her own Lifetime Christmas movie. She had a cameo in the musical Cats. She routinely made the morning talk show circuit. She beat out Gangnam Style for Meme of the Year at the 2013 Webby Awards. And in 2015, she even made her way into partisan politics.
Why is it that Republican politicians are so down on America? Have you noticed that? I mean, they're gloomy. They're like grumpy cats.
Joining us to talk about this and other TV developments is Bob Thompson. Bob's a professor and founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hey there, Bob.
Hey, well, I consulted Purina, and they ought to know. And they say that the first 2 years of a cat's life is about equal to 25 years of a human, and then it's 4 years per year every year thereafter, which would make Grumpy Cat at the passing only 45. So this gets my worst for an untimely death for poor Grumpy.
Did either of you know what his real name was? I didn't know it till yesterday. Did either of you know?
Nope.
Tartar sauce, but I think it's spelled wrong, isn't it?
Spelled with a D. T-A-R-D. Yeah. I didn't know that until yesterday. And I have to say, I am embarrassed to say, I probably paid more attention to Grumpy Cat yesterday after he died than I did during his life, even though I did know who he was.
You were ridiculing me
on
Friday.
We were down
at our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library where there's this huge newsfeed going around, just like Times Square, you know, above the newsfeed cafe. And what was the big headline? It wasn't Donald Trump.
That's true.
It wasn't Iran.
Really true.
It was Grumpy Cat, you ridiculed me for interrupting the show to announce to our listeners that poor Grumpy Cat had met an untimely demise from complications from a urinary tract infection. Poor Grumpy Cat.
Well, I was on the road the day Grumpy died and our Tartar died, Tardar. And I always listened to NPR on terrestrial radio. And they couldn't tell me enough about Grumpy Cat. Public radio was completely enchanted with this story. But that it's interesting that Grumpy Cat got her own Christmas special on Lifetime. Lori Loughlin, of course, did Christmas things on. And it turns out that one of Grumpy Cat's kittens is at USC, and I don't think she got there on her own.
Well, you know,
that's a good one, Bob.
You know,
I actually prepared that ahead of time. I'm sorry.
Let me just say something totally obvious here. I mean, to me, Grumpy Cat was all part of this relief valve, release valve, whatever you want to call it, everybody has now, going on to their phones or wherever they go for cat videos, dog videos, you know, non-bad news, upsetting political news, respite, I think. You know, they're huge, right?
Well, but there's nothing quite like at baby animals, by the way, on Twitter.
Exactly.
I should say.
At baby animals. How much time do you spend there?
About as much.
Right. Cats go way back. I mean, once the internet could start delivering us moving pictures, pornography and cats were the top two things that it did.
Not in that order, of course.
Exactly.
But then, of course, keyboard cat and all the other cats playing piano and the cat that likes the cheeseburgers so much. And this goes back actually before the internet. Remember Hang In There, that cat that was hanging off of a, I don't know what it was.
Oh, from the ceiling fan. Is that what you're talking about? Yeah.
Oh, gosh, that's right.
So cats are something that even before we could get the pictures to move, we've been doing. Oh, in the silent film era, back when Thomas Edison was just experimenting with movies, I just remembered this. They put a bunch of two cats in boxing gloves in a ring, and they had a boxing match. This is this is Thomas Edison silent film. So Grumpy Cat was part of a tradition that goes back about as far as the medium goes.
By the way, you know that thing where the cat was attached to the ceiling fan?
Yeah.
I did that when I was in my fraternity at Penn. It's a long story, but maybe I'll tell it someday.
Yeah, and then the ceiling collapsed. It was
a tragedy.
Oh, my God.
Okay. So that was the worst. What is the best there, Bob Thompson?
Oh, I'm excited about this one. The Sundance Channel, and the problem is you have to either get the Sundance Channel on cable, or I think you've got, if you want to watch these online, you've got to subscribe to it or something. But it's called State of the Union.
Oh, yeah.
And for the last 2 weeks, it's been playing Monday through Friday, and it wrapped up this past Friday. And there are 10 episodes, and each one is from 9 to 11 minutes long. they slipped them in between Law and Order reruns. And it's all 10 episodes are written by Nick Hornby, who, of course, wrote High Fidelity. All 10 are directed by Stephen Frears, who did The Queen and Florence Foster Jenkins and Dangerous Liaisons. And it's about a couple, and they're going to marriage therapy, but it's not the therapy session. It's the they're in a pub the 10 minutes before they go into each session. And it is a interesting, sweet, almost all dialogue story. If you took Bergman's Scenes from a Marriage and made it the exact opposite, that would be State of the Union.
We've got a little clip from this to give people an idea. In this scene, this is Tom and Louise. They're the married couple. They're having a drink before heading into their first marriage counseling session.
It's a long and complicated road that's led us here, don't you think?
I mean, that depends how you look at it. There's the long and the complicated, and then there's as the crow flies.
Talk me through the route your crow flies.
You slept with someone else, and now here we are.
There's a bit more to it than that, isn't there?
Which way do you go, then?
Crow or no crow?
Crow.
You stopped sleeping with me. I started sleeping with someone else.
Oh, my God, that's such a short version and quite crude, if you don't mind me saying.
See, my version's actually longer than yours.
My version explains why we're actually here. Yours is just a short, partial version of the long mess that came before.
By the way, if people, that's Chris O'Dowd and Rosamund Pike, both of whom are brilliant. And there's, it's also funny. It's not just serious and depressing at times. But I have to say, maybe this is obvious to you, Bob, the notion of doing these little episodes in 10 minutes is nothing short of brilliant. I watched a few last night. It is, the concept is fabulous, I think. Has anybody else done this kind of thing?
Well, yes, they have, as a matter of fact. I mean, when the internet first started, before the big shots got involved, most internet programming, webisodes, as they used to call them, tended to be anywhere from 2 minutes to 10 minutes long. My line back then was that 10 minutes is the new War and Peace. But a big deal, or a big shot that did it, was Zwickin Herskowitz, who did My So-Called Life and 30-something and went on to do movies. They did a show called Quarter Life, which was about people in their 20s who are just, you know, not midlife, but quarter life. And those were about 10 minutes long, and they were very well produced in the 30-something kind of way. And they played on MySpace. That tells you how long ago that was. It was a special site on MySpace where they played. And then they would put the 10-minute episodes together, and they were going to turn that into a TV series. So they'd put like four or five of them together. And that played one episode and got canceled. So anyway, this is a tradition that's been going on for a while, but State of the Union does it really well, and not to say too much because most people haven't seen it, but it's almost as though these conversations, even though they're about a marriage that's having problems, it becomes sort of a like a relationship starting. It's almost like they're dating again. It's really done, and as you point out, it's not just depressing scenes from a marriage Bergman kind of stuff. It's very funny, it's clever, and you could swear that there's no script.
Yeah, that's a great point.
It sounds like they're having a conversation.
So it happened last night. Game of Thrones is over, and we're going to play a little clip. Don't worry, we're not going to do a spoiler for those of you out there. We do have sound from the final episode, but we're not going to play it. We thought to get Bob in the mood and us, here's from the final season. It was a callback to this prediction from, let me hope I pronounce it right, Daenerys Targaryen. Here it is.
When my dragons are grown, we will take back what was stolen from me and destroy those who have wronged me. We will lay waste to armies and burn cities to the ground. Turn us away, and we will burn you first.
Okay, so that was season two. So give us your, I mean, we all know about the petition that says redo season eight. We've all read 1,000, even though I've never seen any of them, we have read 1,000 stories about how the final season was really disappointing. How'd the finale measure up there, Bob Thompson?
Well, all I can say is about 10 minutes in, I kept wanting to go to my laptop to check my email.
oh, no.
It was, and I should, you know ahead of time that I have never been quite as enchanted about Game of Thrones as lots of people are. But some of the dialogue when they get a bunch of people together to decide, you know, what's going to happen next, and someone suggests something that sounds like democracy. Oh, yuck, 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 that kind of thing. I mean, the writing on this very talky episode was really, I think, weak and sometimes almost painful. It's not quite. I think generally the consensus I'm seeing is a few people thought it was fine, a bunch of people who are making a fuss, but I don't know anybody who's saying this was in the top, final episodes of all time. I wouldn't put it in the top 100 final episodes of all time. And just breaking, and again, I didn't notice it when it happened, there's a water bottle.
I read, yeah.
Left on the now, you really have to, it's behind a boot. I mean, this one is really a stretch, but I guess once again, that tells us about what season 8 has been all about.
No, but and also next to the water bottle, if you look closely, is a Make America Great Again hat. It's really, that was really unbelievable.
And a little kitty who looks really upset.
But Bob Thompson, I just wanted to ask you about this kind of culture.
By the way, did I tell you about the kitty and the USC kitten?
Yeah, I think I heard that one. Yeah, thank you.
The cultural moment here. You know, I get my Sunday New York Times. I get it delivered every week. I love to get it home delivered on Sundays. And there was a front page story about Game of Thrones on the front page of the New York Times. Two big stories inside. This obviously was a cultural phenomenon. So what was it? Was it that other people saw it differently, or earlier it was better, or what's the deal?
Yeah, no, it was, and I don't mean to downplay it. This got, and especially for a pay cable channel like HBO, the numbers this got, the ratings, the amount of viewers was really extraordinary. And it was so lushly produced. The production values, in spite of some of these little oversights, were incredible, the special effects. And when they would have, it often took place in the second to last episode of each season, filled with surprises if you hadn't read the book. I mean, it really was kind of in a category of itself in television. I think just by the time it got to season 8, it was beginning to kind of wear out. And the other thing, and we talked about this before, I don't know how they could have possibly ended this that would have made us all as excited as we wanted to be. I mean, in the end, it's just it's wrapping things up. And even great novels, when you think about, we don't expect the final chapter of a great novel to somehow blow us away. We expect it to finish things up. We expect it to be consistent with the with the rest of the thing. I love Moby Dick. I loved Moby Dick's final episode, but if that would have been a television show, people would have been complaining.
Okay, so before we leave this, tell Bob what you said earlier on the show, what you thought of the final episode, Marjorie.
Well, Bob, I haven't been following this for all these years, and I figured I should tune in last night for this big cultural event, and unfortunately for me, I watched the wrong episode.
And she thought, what kind of ending is that?
You were better off watching a different episode.
Yeah, I watched the one where Daenerys is on her dragon and she's eviscerated. She's, burning to death of all these people. I thought, this is very cheerful.
Can we talk about another final episode? Well, I never watched Game of Thrones except for like 10 minutes of that Red Wedding thing in season 3 or something. On a number of occasions, maybe it's because of you, or I can't remember, through the years, I watched Big Bang Theory because I knew it was one of the highest rated, longest running comedies ever. I would say I've watched parts of maybe 5 episodes through the years, Bob. And let me be my usual hyperbolic self. That was the least funny, least funny, most staged. I think there's a laugh track, too. I never even smiled once. I don't know how you feel about the show, but what was the allure of this long-term historic comedy?
Well, I think it's the long running, and it was shot in front of a live audience.
It was.
We go way back to even before I Love Lucy. For that, radio sitcoms were shot in front of live audiences sometimes. And I think there still remains a real appeal to these short, simple, half-hour sitcoms. And everybody says the half-hour sitcom is dead. It's a dinosaur in the age of all this great television. We're never going to see them again. They're wrong. The Big Bang Theory was on until Thursday. It beat the living daylights in the ratings out of everything else that was on the air except football. Since its fifth season, it was in the top 10. In the last several seasons, it was in the top 3. It spent one as the number one show. And it's the total opposite of why people watch Game of Thrones or Breaking Bad or any of the shows that we like, or for that matter, this State of the Union that I was just talking about. The Big Bang Theory is, like so many of these sitcoms, so user-friendly, so easy to watch. And it's one of those things that you can be checking your email or diapering the child or answering the door or whatever happens in your domestic space while it's on and still enjoy it. I do disagree with you in that I never thought it was innovative. I never talked the next day to someone about what happened on the Big Bang Theory. I certainly didn't turn the lights off while I watched it. But I thought it was a funny, it did what it did, I think, very well, and pretty much for its entire dozen years, which, let's remember, Friends only, or Cheers only went 11, MASH only went 11.
Mm. Okay.
Okay, so let's move on to something that I did watch the right episode of. this HBO documentary on Muhammad Ali.
Oh, yes, yes.
I loved it.
I did, too, and I learned some stuff. I mean, how many times have we seen documentary stuff on Muhammad Ali? A lot. And this played on Tuesday, I think, HBO. It's two parts, but they played both, one right after the other. And it really got more a sense I got watching this of, first of all, him in the ring. There was a lot of great footage. But also all of the other stuff he was doing with regards to what was going on at the time, civil rights and the war and all of that kind of thing. And this was executive produced by LeBron James,
yeah,
who's really getting into a lot of television work as a producer. The Shop, that kind of talk show that he did, the Million Dollar Mile, which is that big kind of competition show, he's managing to really carve himself out some real space in American television.
We have a little sound here. Here's a clip from Muhammad Ali, What's My Name, showing the reaction, Ali changing his name from Cassius Clay, and the reactions from Malcolm X. Here it is.
How long has Cassius been a black Muslim? Do you know that?
Well, I don't know. Cassius is probably more capable of speaking for himself than any other man in this country.
Cassius Clay is a name no more, is that right?
Yes, sir. It's Muhammad Ali. Muhammad means worthy of all praises, and Ali means most high in the Asian African language.
How long have you had the name?
Well, it's about a 2 weeks now.
Was anybody special gave you the name?
Yes, sir. My leading teacher, the most honorable Elijah Muhammad.
You know, I have to say, I am been obsessed with Muhammad Ali virtually my whole life. I actually went to fights, which are about as exciting as it can be. And I was saying to Marjorie before you came on today, I thought one of the best documentaries I've ever seen is When We Were Kings. I think it won an Academy Award, too.
With
Foreman. But I only watched 15 minutes of this, and Marjorie said she thought the 2.5 hours or whatever was epic. And
because I'm not an expert on these documentaries, but you saw him Golden Gloves as a teenager.
Yeah, I had never seen that.
Which I'd never seen before. I heard him talk about how he became a big deal heavyweight and still couldn't get a cup of coffee in his local diner. All the stuff on civil rights. I love the scenes between him and Malcolm X when he was preparing for the Sonny Liston fight, going around to different places. There was a lot. I just loved it. I thought it was more than I knew before about Muhammad Ali, but I'm not an expert.
And Jim, you did not like it?
No, I so love When We Were Kings. I only watched the first 15 minutes, and I have to say I learned a lot from the first 15. That's the early part of a life, as Marjorie said, through winning the Olympic gold medal in light heavyweight. But I hadn't seen him in his hometown. I hadn't seen him in the Golden Gloves. Photograph for the first guy who gave him $400 a month to live on. I mean, there were just some great, it really, and by the way, for those who don't know What's My Name, this was sort of the underside of Ali to some degree. Ernie Terrell, who he fought for 15 rounds, I remember seeing this fight. Terrell would not call him Muhammad Ali, kept calling him Cassius Clay, and he kept taunting him during the fight as he was
destroying him.
You know, what's my name? What's my name? So that's where the title came. I'm sorry, Marjorie. That's where the title came from.
But there was a great scene of the late Howard Cosell, because when they got into a pregame fight and they almost got into a scuffle, and Howard Cosell's there, keep it rolling.
Cosell was great.
But
with
you
him.
Also get a sense of how really provocative as a black man he was at a time when it was not that easy to be provocative, and even more of a sense of how this was really about race, this attack on him and his not being able to play, be a fighter for 3 years, especially when the Supreme Court, as everybody probably remembers, was unanimous in its decision that he was entitled not to go fight as a conscientious.
But if you read books about the Supreme Court decision, behind the scenes, they say totally about politics. Ultimately, the decision.
The civil rights movement was well in its day. Yeah, but I just that. I don't know. I really liked it.
I can't wait to watch the rest of it. So what are we watching this week in addition to Muhammad Ali? What are we watching? What's coming up?
I am so excited about this. I can barely contain myself.
Really?
What?
Norman Lear, who will turn 97 in July.
Yeah, right.
And Jimmy Kimmel are hosting live in front of a studio audience Norman Lear's All in the Family and the Jeffersons. And they're taking two scripts, one from each of those shows, and I think pretty much going to play them verbatim.
Really?
But they're going to do it live. And check out this lineup. Woody Harrelson and Marissa Tomei as Archie and Edith. That just sounds perfect to me. Jamie Foxx and Wanda Sykes as
Wanda
the Jeffersons.
Sykes.
Pretty perfect, too. Helen Willis is Kerry Washington. Tom Willis is Will Ferrell. And that's without mentioning Anthony Anderson and Sean Hayes and Ellie Kemper. And anyway, an incredible lineup. And they're simply going to do an episode of All in the Family. They're going to do an episode of The Jeffersons. And then there's some half-hour documentary that's going to play afterwards. So this is 2 hours on Wednesday night on ABC. I think it's a spectacular idea. Who knows how it'll work, but just doing it, I think, is worth it.
You know, I had read about it, but I had not read that they were doing an actual script from the shows, which makes it even more engaging than I originally thought. That's terrific.
Well, I'm pretty sure that's what's going to happen. It's live, so we don't know. And by the way, I should point out that that isn't the first time this has been done. NBC did a show called The Rerun Show in the summer of 2002. It went a few episodes in the summer, and it didn't go on. And they took verbatim scripts from The Jeffersons, Facts of Life, Married with Children, What's Happening, Saved by the Bell, Different Strokes, Bewitched, Partridge Family, all these old shows. But they got the actors to read them with these kind of, you know, leering double entendres and stuff. So they were totally updated, even though they didn't change the words. I thought it was a fascinating experiment. It didn't last very long, and we'll see how this this is a one-shot only thing. There's no way you'd get all those actors to commit to a series.
It's very exciting. There's a lot of exciting stuff happening right now. Bob, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. It's much fun.
That was a lot of fun. Thank you.
Yeah, as always, it's always fun. I love talking to Bob Thompson. It's always fun. He's the founding director of the Blyer Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Up next, the Supreme Court deals Apple a major setback in the App Store antitrust case. Tech writer Andy Nacko joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over the latest headlines at the intersection of tech, commerce, and policy is Andy Nacko. Andy's a tech writer, a blogger, a podcaster. You can follow him on Twitter at IHNATKO. Hello, Andy Nacko. How are you?
I am WELL.
Hello, Andy Nacko. So let's start with kind of disturbing news about facial recognition software and the police putting celebrities' pictures into the computers?
Yeah, this was according to an investigation by the Georgetown Law Center on Privacy and Technology. Now, the way that you imagine police using facial recognition technology is that it's like on TV. It's like, oh, well, we know the guy who stole the beer from the – who held up the liquor store. We have this picture on the security camera, and it's like a 5x10 glossy promo picture. And the computer says, bing, it's John, and here's where he lives. But the thing is, security cameras aren't that good. And so it turns – so because police departments have access to this software and there are no rules for how to use it, they thought, well, does he look a little bit like Woody Harrelson to you? Yeah, he does? Okay. Tell you what, let's give the software a picture of Woody Harrelson, and we'll have the software give us a list of – and they turned out a list of suspects, and they arrested one of these people. But it goes to show – how these tools can be abused if they're not really understood. Some of these some officers in New York and elsewhere were doing things like if half of the person's face was not on camera, they go onto Google image search and like paste in an eye and paste in an ear to give more image to the software, or they just have like a really weird doodle or a composite identity sketch, and that's absolutely not what facial recognition software is trained to do. It's bogus.
And by the way, we had I think it was with Carol Rose from the Civil Liberties Union, we've talked about the problems in terms of identifying people of color, the record, it's way off kind of thing. Is the I know Somerville is in the process of contemplating banning it for use by any part of their government, including police. San Francisco has obviously done it. Is this a trend or are these outliers? I mean, I assume that any useful tool most police departments want, even if it's imperfect. And San Francisco and Somerville are not your typical American city. So what's your perception of where we're going here?
This is, right now, facial recognition technology being used by law enforcement is like 100 years ago, a psychologist showing you, well, here's because of the bumps on this person's skull, I can tell that they have criminal tendencies. Mm. There's a lot of things that kind of sound scientific.
Is that primitive, really?
The thing is, it's more of a problem of, again, investigators thinking that it works like CSI Miami or whatever. It really is trained to do one thing specifically, saying, here is a really good picture of an individual. If you show me another picture of that same individual, I will show you, I will pair them up for you, and I'll tell you the probability that I think that these two are the same people. You can't, and the thing is, every time that, even if you do say that, well, the person has his eyes closed, I'm going to paste in some fake eyes, or I'm going to adjust the mouth, you're basically compromising the data you're giving the algorithm and making their results even more unpredictable.
Which of the, by the way, before we leave this, which of the monsters, the huge technology companies are the primary players here?
Amazon is really, really big because they have a system called Recognition, spelled with a K, to make it sound more Soviet and devious. And they're basically giving the software away. Google has a lot more oversight, both internally and externally, because they have some of the best software, but they can't do exactly anything they want with it. They really have to control how they do it. And also, they have a lot more responsibility about how technology works than Amazon does. Amazon's fine. They're just not as good.
We're talking to our tech guy, Andy Anatko.
So we hear a lot about, you know, the trade war, Chinese tariffs and stuff. This piece is about this company, Huawei, if I'm saying it correctly. It does seem to me Trump has a point about what they're doing and what he's trying to prevent them from doing. Tell us.
Yeah, you probably heard about the executive order that he issued last week, basically calling it a national emergency, the idea of foreign states using infrastructure to either compromise our infrastructure or break it to begin with. They didn't mention Huawei in China specifically, but the thing is, even before Trump, for 10 years, the government, going all the way back to Obama, has recognized that Huawei is a very special problem because they are a huge manufacturer of – they're like Sony in that they make phones, they make laptops. Cheap and very, very good. Mm-hmm. They also make like the hardware that a phone carrier needs to create a 5G network in a city. And because 5G is where a lot of money is happening, they're really trying to be the de facto contractor to supply this hardware. Now, and again, it's really good stuff, and it's less expensive than the other two players' hardware, which is Nokia and Ericsson. But the problem is, it's a Chinese company, and although it's very, very easy for some thick-headed people to be kind of bigoted and saying, oh, well, they must be all like communist Chinese, oh, the Chinese are out to get us, there is some question as to who actually owns the company. And also, the Chinese...
The country as opposed to... The government as opposed to individual investors? Is that the debate?
It's... I think it's more apt to say that there's a lot... There's no transparency about who owns it. They say that in their 2018 annual report to investors, they claim that the company is owned by its 96,000 employees. It's a employee-owned company. However, a couple of researchers from George Washington... University and Fulbright, I think, looked into it and discovered that no, it is 100% owned by a holding company, of which 1% of the stock is controlled by the CEO, and the other 99% is by a organization or an outfit referred to as a quote trade union committee. So they're saying something that doesn't seem to be true. And not leaving us with anything to go on as to what's actually going there. But the thing that gets people not thinking it's a smoking gun that they're at the beck and call of the government for their for national interests, but it's a questionable problem. The Chinese passed a national intelligence law in 2017 that, boiling it down to one sentence, it basically says that every individual and every company and organization inside China, if the National Intelligence Service asks it to help them out on an issue regarding national security, they have to actually help them out. So, and there's also kind of a lot of blurred lines between the Chinese government does not own a telecom. However, the telecom knows that if the government asks them to do something and they don't do that, they might lose the right to provide data services in a city.
What's the impact of their business on the consumer in the United States and on businesses in the United States?
Indirect, because they buy a lot of American components. They buy chips from Intel. Their 5G stuff is based a lot on Intel stuff. They buy glass from Corning for their phones.
Oh, really?
They license Microsoft for Windows. A lot of components. As a matter of fact, companies and American companies that are providing this stuff, they saw their stocks take a hit when the part of the order was that no United States company is allowed to do business or export products or sell products to Huawei without an express permission from the government. So they're kind of in a barrel right now. It's a really bad situation for Huawei because they can't move forward with 5G. They can't. They saw this coming, and they stockpiled about 3 months' worth of components that they need to keep the assembly lines working. But they don't know how quickly they can go through that and how they can replace this stuff. And as far as other Americans go, rural communities were kind of hoping that this wouldn't happen because they can't bring 5G to rural communities because they really need to get a bargain here, and they can't afford the Ericsson stuff. They can't afford the Nokia stuff. So there's a lot of stuff in play. I think Huawei is the bigger is getting the bigger hurt of everybody. So we're going to have to see if this turns into brinksmanship or if they manage to sell it.
And just tell us again, Andy Anaka, why 5G is such a big deal.
Basically, because it's for consumers, it's not really such a big deal at all, because our phones right now do pretty much everything we want a phone to do. What it will open up is a lot of technology and infrastructure that wasn't possible because of the limitations of a 4G network. Just to give one example, you can't pilot a car remotely down the highway from a studio over our current broadband network, mobile broadband network, because by the time you see what the camera is seeing in the car and tell it to, oh my God, turn left and don't hit that pedestrian, the pedestrian's already been hit. The 5G network is not only super, super, super fast, but the latency is like next to nothing.
Okay.
So it's almost like a live feed. You're seeing it like with a nanosecond Twitter delay. And that's the sort of thing that 5G will bring.
So let's tell us.
By the way, on that note, remember we had Susan Crawford in here a few months ago,
yes.
That book Fiber, the something like the coming tech revolution. If you want to read something about the future of technology in English for mere mortals like me and Marjorie, it's a great book. It's called Fiber by Susan Crawford.
So I did not even know this existed. That's why it's good we can talk to you, Andy Anaka. This MIT tech flea market?
Yep.
Tell us about this.
She didn't know it existed, but she would have been there. Let me tell you. How'd she know?
Well, I don't know if I would have been there. I mean, I would feel intimidated, but you can. It sounds like it's pretty fun and neat.
It's really cool. It's been going on for decades. It's at the parking garage on Albany Street on the MIT campus. And if you on the third Sunday of every month from April through October, it is just what it sounds like. It is a flea market where people, vendors just set up tables, back up their pickup trucks, and sell all kinds of usually older hardware or secondhand stuff, sometimes vintage, sometimes collectible stuff, and for basically yard sale sort of prices. And again, it's been going on for decades, and it really is a lot of fun because if you're not interested in buying any of this stuff, then it's just fun to see. My God, look at this TRS-80 color computer that someone hacked to be a chiptune musical instrument by adding more switches and more dials. And I'm not going to pay $20 for it even, but I just have to wonder, what does that dial do? I know it has something to do with audio. And sometimes, the latest one was yesterday, and I bought a bunch of stuff ranging from things that were just so weird and so cool and so inexpensive, I just had to have it, to things that I kind of needed, which is like power cords that keep getting lost, and there was a power supply that it was already in my Amazon basket. It was going to cost $14 brand new, but someone, of course, had a big laundry tub full of just unmarked power supplies. I just fished through to, there you go, 5 volts, 2.1 amps. Got it.
So Marie Kondo says you should buy it and then throw it out immediately.
Yeah.
So is this for people like you or mere mortals, to use the expression again? It's not for the latter, right?
It's for everybody.
Really?
Because, again, it's okay to come to the zoo and gawk.
Yeah, exactly.
but you'll also find engineers, you'll find researchers there browsing and selling. Oftentimes, you can find out when somebody's research lab somewhere in the Cambridge area got lost its funding or finished its project, because suddenly there are racks and racks of one of the things I picked up was, I guess someone was doing some sort of feeding lots and lots and lots of lab animals. So it was just this hopper with this little servo motor that would just kick out like one pill or one piece of thing.
And I've been looking for that everywhere, by the way. I can't believe it was there and I missed it.
I bought, there were like a buck, and the guy would say, how about you give me 10 for $5 at your, I just want to get rid of them. And so I turned two of them into a fish feeder. Another one, I think it was like I did an M&M based clock for my nephew.
That's actually pretty clever.
It's a lot of cool stuff. I mean, like even this, this is one of the things I actually bought. This
you
laptop,
bought that?
This holding laptop, up a laptop. This 11-inch Lenovo ThinkPad. Made out of metal, it's black, it looks practically new, very few miles on it. I paid $40 for it.
Wow.
It runs
wow.
Windows. And again, I've been using it I've been typing. The keyboard on this is so much better than anything Apple is shipping right now.
Really?
And so this was
it's great, by the way. Literally about 2 minutes before you started saying that, my computer crashed. And yeah. Mine is not a $40 computer. So there you go. But go ahead.
How many computers do you have? Or laptops?
Only as many as I need. And no more. I need all of these.
So do you want to go? When's the next one, Marjorie? When's the next one?
Third Sunday of June is going to be the next one. Gates open at 9 a.m. It's usually kind of over at 11 or noon. $5 to get in if you want to get in early while people are setting up and get first crack at the cool stuff.
What do you think, Marjorie?
I'm not sure it's my kind of.
You don't think so? Okay. By the way, you could buy one of those single pill things and buy a rat down the street.
Okay.
And you could just,
okay. I wanted to bring, in case it came up, I was going to use this laptop anyway, because I was shopping. I had my eyes peeled for months on a little computer that I could just use for a little project. Mm-hmm. This was it. But I also brought with me one of the coolest things I ever bought. And it is this thing that looks like a high school ring. It's like a little silver. It really looks like a high school ring.
What is it?
This is actually a computer made in 1996. With a system clock, encryption, input, output. It was the very, very first tap-to-pay system. This has a whole operating system on it. Even though it has no buttons, has no lights, it just has what looks like but isn't a thick watch battery on the top. The way it works is that, like, if I wanted to, like, unlock this door and it was set up for the system, there'd be, like, a little blue pad. All I got to do is, like, I don't have to say Wonder Twin Powers activate, but I probably would, and just tap it with the ring. As soon as it makes that metal contact, power is sent to the ring. It runs a piece of software that says, who is this guy with the ring? That's Andy. Is Andy allowed to enter? Yes. Okay, let him in.
I love that. A magic ring, Jim.
And the keyboard goes in your underpants, by the way. I don't know if you know.
And again, I had never heard of this thing. until like I saw a digital decoder ring stamped on the outside
okay.
of it.
How much did it cost this, please?
This one, I think, cost me $10, $5.
Oh, well,
they gave them out at a 1996 developer conference, and so someone who went to that conference 3 years later, Marie Kondo'd the heck out of it and decided that he doesn't have a
that
ring.
I could see buying. Actually.
Yeah, they said they also have used computers, but how would you know if a used computer was any good? I used to get those. Remember, we used to get those trash 80s over at Microsoft. They would be refurbished computers. I got them for my kids. They were great. But of course, then you felt like if they weren't great, you could bring them back to Microsoft.
Yeah. You got to punch your weight. Oftentimes, you'll see computers almost like by the pile or by the pound. Like, again, an office with 40 computers decided to upgrade everyone's computer, and they just sold – they either gave them away, said anybody who can just come with a pickup truck, come take it away. And oftentimes the hard drives will be pulled out. There's no deception happening. I probably wouldn't be buying a – if I were shopping for a working computer, I would have to take a seeing eye nerd with me if I didn't know about computers. There are lots of values out there, lots of bargains out there. You just have to make sure you don't get distracted by this is actually so old that it's not really worth even fixing up, and it will need lots of fixing up.
I'd stick to the rings if I were you,
okay,
Marty.
I'll go and get a magic ring.
That's what most people see. They'll see something weird, say, I don't know what this is.
No, I'd do that in a second for 10 seconds. So, Andy, before you go, we're going to talk to our listeners in a couple of seconds about this quiet mode thing on Uber. This is more a human question than a technology question, I think. But you are a human in addition to a tech expert.
I'm flattered that I've pulled the wool over people's eyes.
It's a beautiful thing. How do you feel about this?
You know, I think it's okay because I, oddly enough, I'm one of those rare nerds who has some social interaction, like timidity and shyness.
Yeah.
And there are times where I kind of like I've been working like all day long, and finally I get to go home, and I'm not even going to take the train home. I'm going to pay $30 to be driven home to, and I really don't have the energy to speak to somebody. But the driver wants to be friendly and wants to get good ratings, and so they want to have a conversation. And I don't have the social software to say, I love you, you're wonderful, but I really don't want to talk to anybody right now. So I think
that's very common.
Yeah.
Because you feel like it's rude.
And also there's some women who are reacting to it saying that I don't want to I could check a box to say, don't even take the risk that you're going to say something sexist or is going to make me feel like I'm not in a safe place. That's good, too. It's only available for Uber Black. That's why it's getting a lot of conversation. Because, oh, so the rich people can say, driver, don't offend me by stringing your pedant words into my air. But they also has a section for in the same set of features, a checkbox saying, hey, I'm going to need help with my luggage. Or, hey,
make sure
you don't have the air conditioning too high because I don't like it too cold. I would love to do that if I had checkboxes that basically said that I frighten easily, I run out of small I have 3 minutes of finely tuned small talk, and please don't try to make me come up with minute number four of it.
Andy, it's good to see you.
Andy,
thanks.
Thank you very
love
much.
The ring.
And thank you for telling us about that thing over at MIT. You never know. I could be inspiration.
I think I know, Marjorie. I don't think you'll be there.
I'll help carry the stuff out to your wagon, to your station wagon.
Thank you. Andy Nutko joins us regularly. He's a tech writer, blogger, and podcaster. You can follow him on Twitter at Nutko. That's IHNATKO. Thank you very much, Andy Nutko.
See you, Andy.
Up next, we're going to talk about what we just talked about with Andy. Shut up and drive, opening the lines and asking you about Uber's new quiet mode offer. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Bradley, Marjorie again. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to tech writer Andy Nutko about Uber's new quiet mode. Last week, Uber rolled out these options for riders to customize their trips. Andy mentioned a few of them, such as help with luggage, needing more time to reach your pickup spot, the temperature of the car. And if you want a quiet car, meaning no small talk with your driver. So we're going to take your calls for the next few minutes, asking you if this is one more step towards dehumanization. Are we now so inept at communication that it's just easier to tell our driver in advance that we don't want to engage? Or is this the best thing that ever happened? You wish you could apply the do not disturb sign to all situations like work or the hair salon, the dog park, an elevator. And Uber drivers, if you're listening, or Lyft drivers, even though it doesn't apply there yet, how do you like this? Are you insulted if someone employs quiet mode? Do you wish you could do the same to your customers? The number is 877 800-516-1380-301-8970. So you sort of articulated your position, but say it again. What is it?
Well, I just, you don't want to be rude to somebody that starts talking to you. But
some, won't start talking to you if you do this.
Right, they won't. But that seems really rude to say, shut up and drive. I mean, I think you have to really man and woman up and text them and tell them that you don't want them to
Could
talk
you ever
to you.
Say to someone, and by the way, I think a lot of ride-sharing drivers talk to you far more than they want to also. I have a feeling a lot of them might welcome this because they sort of feel they have to engage, be sociable, so they get five stars or whatever. Do you? I don't have the ability to say to a driver, by the way, I've got to finish this project. By the time I get to the end,
once.
Can you please not talk to me?
I've said that once because someone was, it wasn't an Uber driver, but it was one of these. I was going to give a talk somewhere and they picked me up in a very nice limo to drive down to the event. And I did say to the driver, hey,
you did?
I don't mean to be a jerk, but I've got a lot of work to do in the car, so I got to like shut up and get to work. He was very nice about
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah.
But how many times can you do that? I mean,
well, it's, if you're only going like a 5-minute drive, but if you're going like for an hour, then I think you have to muster up your courage. But you do feel, you know, sometimes I talk about their cars. A lot of them are in Toyotas. So we talk about Toyotas for a while because I've had Toyotas forever. I go through the mileage of my Sienna before I get rid of it, then the Highlander, and now my ridiculous.
Did you tell them about how you didn't have any bumpers at the end of each of the car ownerships? Bumpers
I think that was only the Sienna that lost.
Well, you
its
didn't
bumper.
Have a. That's true, right?
Yeah. So I talk about Toyotas.
So you like this thing in the abstract? You just think it's rude, and I'm exactly where you are, by the way.
Yeah. Can you imagine sending it, having a check off a little thing that says, "Tell the driver to shut up."
But can I tell you what the difference is, and then we'll take calls at 877-301-8970. If you tell a person face to face, the driver, he or she may take it personally because maybe you're reacting to them. If you do it when you order the ride, it's not a personal statement because you don't even know who they are.
That's true.
So it isn't like they would take it in the same way that they might take it as a slight. So I feel the same way you do. I think it's sort of rude, but if you do want quiet at certain times, at least, I think this is far better than having to engage the individual and saying, please don't say anything to me.
Steven says, how about an option that tells your Uber driver what side of the political divide you're on? Select MAGA mode, and the driver will loudly complain about immigrants. Select the opposite, and he'll lay out the case for impeachment. How about that?
That is absolutely great.
That's a very interesting idea.
877-301-8970. Laurie in a car, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Laurie, what's up?
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. It's Laurie. I'm from Paxton, actually.
Hi, Laurie from Paxton.
Do you remember
great
Laurie from Paxton, as in last year at the Chef's Gala, whatever
that's
thing?
That's right.
Hey, Laurie, what's up?
Yes. So here's my thing. I just had my hair done, and hairdressers want to talk to you. Massage therapists want to talk to you. So I really live by this rule. It is none of my business what anyone else thinks of me. So if I want to talk, I talk. And when I had my hair done, I told Jill, I said, I need to decompress. My head feels like a ping pong ball going back and forth, and I can't talk. So I just respectfully say whatever I need. And if somebody doesn't like it, that's their issue to deal with. So we all need to practice sticking up for ourselves and getting what we need.
That was great, Lori. Do you have the same courage she do?
No.
Does?
No.
I mean,
don't.
That is the way. Thank you, Laurie. That is the way we should live, is it not? Is being candid with people. Please don't take it personally. I just, whatever she said about ping pong balls in my head kind of thing. I need a little peace and quiet to decompress. So please don't
bother
me. Think
about that. Hairdressers must get awfully tired having to chat everybody up all day long.
See, I think the more I think about this, the more what I said a minute ago I think is true, is the vast majority of these drivers don't want to talk to you either. They feel they have to. So they might feel some relief if you in advance say to them, no need to talk. In fact, don't talk.
Carmen just emailed, I drive for Uber. You want to chat? Great. You don't? Even better. I want to get you to your destination safely and comfortably, which is all I really
That's
care
efficient.
About, actually.
Really?
Yeah. You know, I mean,
the only exception to this, I want to be as candid as I can be because I try to be on the radio. Even if I did the quiet mode thing, if someone recognized me, I'd like them to say something. If they were to say, you're not Jim Browdy, are you? And I would say, well, actually, I am. And can I waive quiet mode at this point? Then I you don't think there's some merit to that?
Tell us, Mr. Browdy, how did you get to be a star of stage,
Thank you.
Screen,
I'd be
TV,
happy to.
Radio.
Is that your question? Thank you. Let me expound upon that. Peter Nicar, you're next on Boston Public Radio.
Again, at the Wawa supermarket.
We're talking about
Where I was arrested.
Well, I was not arrested, by the way. I quit in protest because they were doing lie detector tests on my coworkers. Peter in the car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Jim, I got to be honest with you. I'd play it cool and say, hey, you look a lot like Jim Browdy. You know, I wouldn't definitely just come out and say, wow, I remember you when you used to work for that other talk radio station. But
that's right.
That'd be good enough for
me,
Peter.
That's
right. So, Peter, you an Uber driver?
I am an Uber driver.
Oh, great. So what do you think about this?
And I think they should put it across the board, not just for the rich people, and here's why. When I started driving for Uber, I didn't realize that they allowed customer feedback. So about 4 or 5 months in, I got some customer feedback that said, GP, you talk too much.
Oh,
so
no.
For the next three weeks, I decided to play it cool. I kind of talked a little less. I didn't engage in conversation as much. And about 3 weeks later, I got customer feedback that said, hey, Pete didn't talk enough. He should have engaged me in conversation. So I finally decided that I'm just going to do me. And it's not like it's not without warning, because on my profile it says, I love a great conversation. So if you get in my Uber, you should expect to be engaged in conversation. But if you warn me ahead of time that you don't want a conversation, I've come to a place in my life where I can curb my enthusiasm and not talk.
Peter, don't go away. Would you be offended, though, if I don't know you when I make that request? So would I offend you anyway if I said in advance, please don't speak to me?
Absolutely not. As a matter of fact, I try not to engage people in conversation, for instance, who I sense aren't facile in the English language. Because I'm not facile in their language, and I don't want to put them on the spot and try and engage them in a conversation that they, quite frankly, are uncomfortable with because they're not facile in my language.
Peter, you're a good one. I hope I get you someday in the car. You're a good guy.
But
Peter, thank you for the call.
You go to the quiet cars in the train.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah,
all the time.
Those are hysterical because everybody's really, I mean, they are there because it's the quiet car. And if someone does dare get on their phone, they get about 30 seconds on their
phone before somebody
comes over there
and
interrupts them.
But the reason that's different, and I have, I'd say 50% of the time I probably do that, is there, that's protecting against somebody who is incredibly rude and selfish, somebody who gets on their phone and is speaking loudly in a non-quiet car. So that, and you're also not directing it at an individual, so that's a lot easier for me, don't you know?
Yeah, there's huge peer pressure in there for people to keep quiet. I mean,
exactly.
it's a beautiful thing to see in action. Ginny in Boston, thank you for calling.
Hello, Ginny.
Hi there. Yes, I love the Amtrak quiet car.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with what Peter said and what Lori said. I don't really want to engage too many strangers in conversation, but what I would really love to have is an Uber app that would allow me to deny getting in a car with highly tinted windows.
Huh. Why does that bother you?
Scary.
Well, yes, indeed. I don't even like driving and looking over at somebody.
Neither do I.
Oh, yeah.
Doing.
I hadn't thought of that. That is a good point because you might meet some
dangerous
situation in the car and no one could see you. I hadn't thought of that.
By the way, I hadn't even thought about it either. And I assumed, apparently naively, because I guess you've experienced this, that ride shares wouldn't even allow ride share drivers whose car had tinted windows. Have you ever seen it, Ginny? Or you're just, this
yes,
is.
Yes, indeed, I have.
Well,
I left the window open. My window open.
Wise move.
My window is open, indeed.
That would make me nervous, too. Ginny, thanks.
Didn't our buddy Bernier say he got pulled over with a tinted window?
I can't remember.
I thought he said he did. And
but he's not driving somebody else.
No, but I mean, it made me think that there's something legally questionable about them. I don't know that I shouldn't say. Paul is a former chauffeur. He says, and the job is just driving, and passengers know that. It should cost extra to engage someone in superfluous or political conversation.
Let's go to Jackie in Cambridge. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about quiet mode, the new quiet mode on certain ride shares with Uber. Hi.
Hi. I don't like it at all because I'm a chatterbox, and especially with the non-American-born drivers,
mm-hmm.
I've learned how to say thank you in many languages. I've gotten history lessons. I've given English lessons. I think it's just a really fun way. I try to hop in the front seat and chat away. And when I get a driver that doesn't, I'm sitting there trying not to squirm to talk.
Wow.
Boy, I'll tell you, congratulations to you, Jackie. That's great. And Jackie raised an issue that I think is a more interesting issue in some ways. When you go in rideshare, do you get in the back seat or the front seat if you're by yourself?
Back seat.
Yeah, I always get in the front seat.
You do?
Yeah, because it's almost like there's a servant relationship, I feel, when you're the only person and you're in the back. I'm really, really uncomfortable. I know I'm trying to make myself sound like some sort of great, you know,
whatever. You are, actually.
Yeah, but
I mean, there is a service relationship.
I know, but it's really
unpleasant.
Yeah, but it's
maybe they don't want you sitting next to the gym.
Well, I always ask.
Yeah.
I always ask, and they say no, and I say, well, I'm doing it anyway. And they have to clear off all their stuff.
Yeah.
They've got all their.
I mean,
their,
I feel like that's their space.
I am not
that you're
comfortable
invading.
Sitting in the.
Do you,
really
do, so you do that in a taxi too?
No.
What's the difference?
I don't know. I feel it's a much more personal encounter because it's their car, I guess. I don't know. I knew you were going to ask that. I'm sorry I brought it up now because I don't do it in a cab.
They had a really terrible, upsetting story about all these poor taxi drivers in New York City in the front page of the New York Times.
Because of rideshare?
Medallion, bogus loans where people said they made $100,000 when they made $25,000. They were instructed to do that to get these loans from medallions and how their lives have been ruined. It's a really
sad
story.
Because now the medallions are worth almost nothing.
Exactly.
But do you remember the story in Boston a few weeks ago? Where were they saying medallions hit as high as, what was it, 700 grand at one point in Boston, and now they're in the low, the 30s,
yeah.
the 35s. And a lot of these men, this is their life savings. This is their
yep.
investment.
Yep, they're going to retire on those.
I know.
It's terrible.
Peggy in Rhode Island, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about a quiet mode at Uber. Hi.
Hey, how are you all?
Excellent.
I'm calling because I think that the drivers in Providence and the surrounding area must be very different from the drivers in Boston.
Why?
Because I use Uber several times a year going to either Boston Airport or the Warwick Airport. And I get in the car, hey, how are you? Good morning. And nothing. It's like pulling teeth to get them to talk to you. And I'm thinking, should I shut up and not say anything or... I don't know. I want to get a feel for this guy or girl. Now, I've taken Ubers in California and Florida. Never had any issues. Never.
Hey, Peggy, when you take the Uber to Logan, where are you coming from?
Lincoln, Rhode Island.
Wow. So how much does that cost?
Actually, if you take an early morning flight, it's about $60. Cheap.
That's not that bad. That's a long way.
When I travel with my husband, we go to the Logan Express and take the bus into Boston. But when I'm traveling by myself, which happens often, I just would rather have an Uber take me right to the airport. And it's cheap, actually.
Peggy, you know what maybe you should have? Maybe in Rhode Island there should be an app saying the driver has to talk to you as opposed to...
I know!
Peggy,
hey,
thank you.
They offer you water, candy.
Oh, that I was in Washington, D.C. a few months ago, and it's funny you say that. It is such a – it's almost like a cultural divide. I would say 50% of the – I mostly do Lyft. The Lyfts that were in Washington, D.C. did exactly what Peggy said, offered you a drink,
yeah.
offered you candy, offered you popcorn.
I've gotten a lot of water.
Yeah. Peggy, thanks.
Thank you. Let's,
Roberta.
Roberta in Dorchester. Hi, Roberta.
Hi, Roberta.
Hi. Oh, my God. I would love this feature across the board.
You would?
Oh, my God. Because, like, I'm transgender, right? And I've been driving for Uber and Lyft for, like, about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I look the part. Okay. Mm-hmm. Like, my facial features are really feminine. I'm a 36C. Okay. And people come into my car and engage me in conversation, and I have like a serious post nasal drip that makes me sound like a gay Darth Vader, and when they come in, I'm like, how are you, where are you going, blah blah blah, and I try to do it in the highest octave that possible, just so like there's no like they're not confused.
But you're saying, Roberta, you don't just want the app. You don't want to be required to speak to the passenger ever anyway. Is that where you're going?
Yeah, pleasantries in the beginning. Like, I can hold my own for, hi, hello, and then they get in, and it's just like, if they engage me in conversation, that's fine, but, like, so you get bad reviews. Like, sometimes, like, they will engage you in conversation, and then you reciprocate, and then you get like feedback saying that like, oh, you talk too much.
Yeah, that's like I was saying like, before.
Yeah, exactly. So it's just, oh my God, I would love this.
Oh my God. Roberta, thanks for your time. We appreciate your call. Thanks so much.
Okay, so I don't know if we've come to consensus, have we?
I don't know, exactly what I think I said at the beginning of this is a lot of the drivers would like this as well. It isn't like they're loving imposing their ideas on us and we're the ones trying to defend. I think we had a few drivers who said, I'd prefer not to have to talk, as Roberta said, other than the pleasantries at the beginning. That's a perfect compromise as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, coming up, John Waters is here to talk about his new book, Mr. Know-It-All. Stay tuned for that. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. At age 73, John Waters, famed director, actor, writer, seems less like the Pope of Trash and more like the Patriarch of Transgression. It's at least who you'll find in his latest book. It's called Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Filth Elder. It's part memoir, part tell-all, full of insight, irreverence, and Waters' own brand of advice for young people just starting out to septuagenarians who just want to drop out. You got it. He even writes about LSD. You can catch John tonight at 7 o'clock at the First Parish Church in Harvard Square, an event sponsored by the Harvard Bookstore. To get tickets, go to harvard.com. John, it's great to see you again. Thanks for being here.
Thanks.
Great
Thanks
to see you. Thank you
back.
So much for coming in. So I rarely ask authors to do this, but I thought the first paragraph of your book is so great and kind of sums things up. I wanted you to read
okay,
it for
Okay, here it goes. Okay. My first reading from this book
it's
ever.
It's very exciting, right, actually.
Somehow, I became respectable. I don't know how. The last film I directed got some terrible reviews and was rated NC-17. 6 people in my personal phone book have been sentenced to life in prison. I did an art piece called 12 A-holes on a Dirty Foot, which is composed of close-ups from porn films. Yet a museum now has it in their permanent collection, and nobody got mad. What the hell has happened?
So there you go. There's my first question. What the hell has happened?
That if they can't get rid of you after 50 years, they learn to embrace you. Maybe that's it.
You're like, are you totally respectable now, John Waters, or just a little bit?
Well, I don't know. What I'm just saying, all that's true.
Yeah.
And what I do still, I mean, this new book has stuff that is completely outrageous in it, certainly. So, but no one seems to get mad anymore. And I think the real secret of any success I've had is that I only make fun of things I love.
Oh, that's a very good
point.
So
I'm never really mean because I certainly look up to the things that I'm making fun of, including myself.
So, John, LSD at 70. This seems that virtually every writer that comes in here has done LSD this year. Michael Pollan was in a few months ago.
But he did it this year?
Well, it was last year,
no,
actually.
No, microdoses.
I don't know what he did. T.C. Boyle was in, what's the name of his, Outside Looking In, whatever his thing is.
Yeah, he wrote a book about Timothy Leary.
So what's with, I mean, I have to say, I would like to, am I going to say do it again? Well, I may have experimented when I was a kid. I'm too nervous at an advanced age to try it. Were you?
Well, if I had known how strong it was going to be, I would have been really nervous. But once we did it, whoa, 12 hours of hallucinating at 70 years old. It was fun. And, you know, I haven't done it for 50 years. And I did it with Mink Stoll, my oldest friend who I've known for 50 years, and another friend, a younger friend. And to me, I just wanted to see what it was like. It was my stunt of the book. It was the same way I hitchhiked across the country by myself when I was in my 60s, to challenge myself. And my mother always used to say, don't tell young people to take drugs. I'm not. Young people shouldn't take LSD. Old people should, because we're not having a senior moment. We're tripping!
Exactly.
So is it good enough that you're doing it again?
Or
is this a one and done? Why not?
Well, because I remember what it was like. It was so amazing, and it opened up. It was really, really did what it's supposed to do. You realize there could be anything out there that we don't know about. So I absolutely loved it, but I don't feel that I have to do it again. I know what it was like to hitchhike across the country, too. I'm happy I did it. I know that if I had to, I could hitchhike across the country. I guess if somebody told me they just dosed you, which would be the worst ever, meanest thing to do, I'd say, well, I've done this. But we planned on it for so long and took really with somebody that was really safe and comfortable and old friends.
So were you one with the universe? Was this a great spiritual moment?
No, Mink even said before, if anybody sees God, keep it to yourself.
Okay. All right. So
we did play the same music I used to play. We played Dionne Warwick singing Once in a Lifetime because Divine used to trip and lip sync that number. I played Born Free, the corniest soundtrack ever.
Oh, gosh.
Which still is hilarious when you're tripping. And also all the Fellini soundtracks.
Oh, perfect. Perfect soundtracks. So let's talk about some of your favorite things and some of your least favorite things. Let's start with the favorite things first. You can bond together. Jim told me this morning he sees you on your bicycle all the time.
Oh, we're going right down Commercial Street all the time.
My old beat-up bicycle, yeah.
So this is in your section about, this is like a no vacation vacation.
Yeah.
Where you're there from Memorial Day to Labor Day.
Yeah, but I'm working. I only take off for an hour and a half each day, and I go to the beach. But certainly, I wrote this book there. I wrote most all my movies there. This is my 54th summer in Provincetown. So
that's wonderful.
Really, yeah.
And you get some great little anecdotes about going to get your newspapers from a person that was involved in one of the most notorious crimes.
Oh, and he's such a handsome. He's the greatest Tony Jacket, who was innocent of the whole thing.
Yeah,
and everything
Crystal Worthington. Tell people about that.
Well, no, he was the prime suspect before, but he's also my paper guy, and I love him, and he's really conscientious about it and make sure, because I get 5 or 6 newspapers delivered every day.
I love that.
And so he's great. And he's also been a friend forever. I know his whole family and everything. But every once in a while you think, he was a suspect in the case. He was completely innocent and was exonerated.
Yeah,
completely.
Someone else went to prison.
Christopher McCown. Yeah. You think he did it, the guy they convicted?
Maybe. I know Tony didn't.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Maria Fluke, by the way. Remember that book that was
huge for a while? Now, do you actually take the bus to Provincetown?
No, I have in my life taken it when I missed the plane. But now Cape Air is so great to me, they give me a car sometimes. Cape Air is the best. But I have taken the bus in my life. I've hitchhiked to Provincetown. The first time I ever went there 50 years ago, well, it was in 1964. I'm at 50.
55.
Yeah. Someone said to me, oh, you'll like it. It's a weird place. I went, oh, okay. I hitchhiked there. It was. I did.
Well, you know, I've been going there for decades, too, not 55 years, but you're right. It hasn't. To me, it's exactly the same as it was 55 years ago. Do you mean in your head? I mean, I didn't...
It's always. It was expensive then. It was a resort.
But there are other parts to it than the expense.
Well, it's gayer, but it was always gay. They called it an artist colony.
Artist colony, that was a code word.
Yeah, code word. Yeah, hippies can't live there. Young people can't live there. You know, it's the same thing. And you go into the market and you say, where are the turnips? And they say, what is a turnip? Because no one... Well, I understand. Do I know the word for turnip in Russian? No, that's hard. Turnip is not the first word you learn in a foreign language.
So you also told us a great story about Cape Air that I didn't even know about. This is not really... The diabetic pilot?
Well, yes, who passed out in the middle of it, and a person had to land the plane. It's better than Karen Black in Airport 70, whatever that one was, in the dark and everything, and the winter, and when the airport wasn't even open, and she did it, and everyone lived. It's a harrowing story.
Is that a true story?
Yes, it's really true.
By the way, for those who haven't ridden Cape Air, the pilot does everything. The pilot loads your bags.
And there's only one.
There's one, right?
They have a heart attack. Too bad.
And you're kind of sitting right behind him or her, so you can see them from your seat. Sometimes they have a curtain.
The worst thing, no curtain I've ever been on. Somebody said to me recently, I met, you know, once you were sitting next to me on Cape Air and we had a little turbulence and you whispered to me, Ricky Nelson, Patsy Cline, Otis Redding. And I'm sure I did do that. That is something I would have done.
Terrible.
But I didn't remember it. I didn't remember it.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you hit the plane now. Now, some things you're not that fond of. Catholic Church, you really did a number on
No, they've been harassing me and my kind for decades, for centuries.
Well, kind too, actually.
Yeah,
no.
So... They've been mean to heterosexual people that had abortions. I'm just saying. They've been mean for everybody. So I feel no guilt about saying terrible things about them.
Yeah.
They've harassed me my whole life. They tried to make me feel bad. They tried to tell me I couldn't see movies. They tried to do everything. They've been against gay people forever and ever. And this new pope, I think he's worse than any of them. Because
he says,
who am I to do? Who are you? You're the pope. That's who you are. You can do anything. You're infallible.
Well, you do make great points, which is enraging to a lot of people who are also Catholics, to say, well, you know, we have to have, who am I to judge, but does he change the church's, you know, edicts against gay people? No, no, he doesn't. Or we have sympathy for people that have abortion. Will he change even a modicum the attitudes towards abortion? No, they don't. So they're great
points. Well, he tried to have a year of mercy where he would, like, well, when he gets pregnant, he can have mercy.
We're talking to John Waters. I'm sure you recognize the voice. Mr. Know-It-All, the tarnished wisdom of a filth elder.
Okay, now here's something else I wanted to ask you about. I had not heard of the restaurant, The Prune, in New York City, but apparently...
Oh, it's a great one, yeah.
This is your favorite restaurant in New York. Why is it your favorite restaurant in New York?
Well, because they order, you would just say, an appetizer. It's one big carrot with a hairy and, you know, and it's delicious. They take the most... They serve... Jell-O that is absolutely fantastic. What
really?
Can you do to Jell-O? I don't know.
I don't know.
So it's such
usually
a great
it's awful.
Restaurant that reinvents the normalest thing, the most normal thing your mother ever made you that you rejected in a great way. So that's why I fantasize with this new restaurant I want to run called Gristle, which is the most beyond edible foodie restaurant ever that makes you die from eating and you like it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, John, when you were coming in this morning and Marjorie and I were talking about you, I realized, and I think you may have said this in an interview written in the book, you haven't done a feature film in quite a while.
Oh, over 10 years. Yeah,
so
yeah, more,
is that by your choice or by the industry's choice?
Both. I think I've been paid to write movies from Hollywood with great salaries, everything, three or four times.
Didn't
since,
you have an HBO thing
them.
Happen?
Oh, yeah, the HBO with Harris for everything. So it's a different world. They want independent films to cost $1 million now. I don't want to go backwards. I can't say to people, well, you work for me for nothing. I've only made 17 movies. And, you know, can I go on Kickstarter when I own three homes?
Do you miss it? I mean...
No.
You
no,
do.
I'm
don't
busier
you?
Than I've ever
no,
been
I know
in my life.
I know you're doing a million things. And art,
do I miss it? No, because I just need to tell stories. And the last two books did better than my last movie. So I like to do it where the people are the most eager to hear it. And plus, all my old ones, Criterion keeps re-releasing. They're doing Polyester next year. They did Multiple Maniacs. They did Female Trouble. They restore them. They keep coming out, and they're still available. So, yes, if somebody came to me and said, oh, this last movie you didn't get made, would you make it? I would, yeah. I still have meetings about it.
How long has Divine been dead? Decades, right?
Since 88.
Was this a high school connection? I can't remember.
We grew up in the same neighborhood. I always said he was the girl next door, sort of, but four houses away. Uh-huh. And Divine wasn't transgendered in any way. He didn't want to be a woman. He wanted to be Godzilla.
Uh-huh.
We thought him up to scare hippies.
You know, I'm looking at you. I said at the beginning, I assume it's okay. You talk about your age, too, that you're 73 years old. And I'm looking at you. You look remarkably fit.
You do.
And I don't mean to pry, but you don't look like the kind of guy who'd be going to a gym to
no.
be working.
I've never been. I'm the only gay man you ever met that has never been to the gym or the baths. Picture me walking around trying to get laid in a towel. It's just not how I would operate. And gym, I still hated it from high school, hanging on those ropes thinking, I'll kill you. I felt rage hanging on those ropes and not being able to
yeah.
go. I have no desire to go
so
to
what's
gym.
The trick? What's the prune?
Cooking Light magazine that went out of business. When
I was subscribed to Cooking Light, too, actually.
I missed that. How am I supposed to eat anymore?
No, that's a problem.
I walk in New York. I walk in San Francisco. And in Baltimore, as you know, you run.
How long did you smoke 5 packs of King Cools?
I'll tell you. I haven't had a cigarette in, I write it down every day,
oh my goodness,
5,980 days.
Wow.
By the way, he really
so
did
you
just
smoked,
pull something out of his pocket to look at.
You smoked for a good part of your life.
Oh, I
life.
Smoked from the moment my mother, when I was a kid, said, oh, let me have a drag of that cigarette. She said, oh, sure, he'll hate this. And I took a drag and I smoked ever since.
So
yeah. It's the only thing I regret in America. It's the only thing the government ever told you that was true. Smoking does kill you, and my friends now are dying from it.
So tell us about quitting.
It was the worst thing ever. I got needles in my neck, and Robert Downey Jr. took me to the no-smoking clinic in Beverly Hills, where they shot you in the neck. And later, I gave the brochure to my psychiatrist. He said, there's nothing in here. There's medicine they give pregnant women who fear birth. I said, that's a medicine? I never heard of that one.
We're talking to John Waters. The book is Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Filth Elder.
You know, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, you've got great chapters in here. One of my favorite titles, How to Judge a Hotel Room. How do you judge a hotel room, John Waters?
By the trash cans. You can tell immediately. If they have a plastic one anywhere, there should be one in every room if you're lucky enough to have a suite. Anything with a liner bag in it, you know, is déclassé.
It's bad.
It should be black. The best, if it's a single black leather in every room, your career has arrived.
Do you steal the toiletries or not?
No, I don't.
That's really
because I like La Mer cream, you know, which is the most ridiculous. And no hotel is that cool.
Okay,
wait a minute. La Mer that you get like in high end, like Bloomingdale's. The skin
you said
cream?
How if I look, I owe it to. Believe me, you need to get your eyeglasses checked. But I do. I'm addicted. It's the
because
most pitiful thing.
Some people do say the former Attorney General of Massachusetts, Martha Coakley, said that La Mer cream was a secret of her great looking skin into her 60s. Now, do you think it's done wonders for you? Because maybe
I don't think my skin looks so great, but I just always imagine every day when I put it on, I think how much it costs. Imagine how much worse I'd look if I didn't use it.
Yeah. Boy, maybe I should go back out to Bloomingdale's and buy some.
So, John,
my dermatologist said Pond's cold cream would work
really?
As well, but I don't believe him.
We talk a lot about activism on this show, and I will channel my colleague here, Marjorie Egan, who says about once a week, you know, if they raise the cost of college a dollar in France, there are a million people in the streets. They could torture 100 million people in this country and we'd do nothing. Well, you have a little bit of advice. I think it's Act Bad, is the title of that chapter. So what does Act Bad mean? What should we be doing?
Well, first of all, students, stop studying. Why aren't they? What do you mean? You're studying with what's going on today? You should be out in the streets. I had fun at riots. I got laid. I met people. I have lasting friends. But I never got beat up. I knew to stand in the back. So I'm saying that protest to use, I think the group that uses it the best today, like the Yippies use it as the Satanic Church. The Satanic Temple.
Yeah,
because
you're big fans of them.
And that's a hilarious movie about them called Hail Satan? Question mark. I don't believe that. Are they Satanists? I mean, I'm certainly not. I wouldn't have a thing to wear to a goat sacrifice. But at the same time, they use humor to embarrass the enemy, which is what the Yippies used to do. And with this administration, it would be so easy to. I mean, you look at him, and he does look now, Trump, like a white James Brown impersonator. I mean,
With the white eyes.
You're glossing over the first part of this. Humor, to you, is the key to activism because it allows you to connect
humor
to real
people.
Humor
can be terrorism.
Right? Yeah.
In a good way that doesn't injure anybody physically but mentally embarrasses them. And that's how you get rid of candidates you hate is to embarrass them.
Did I read in some interview you criticized Elizabeth Warren, not for her politics,
but
for her humorlessness?
Oh, she's never said a funny thing in her life. I've never heard her say one thing funny ever.
And you think that limits her appeal?
Oh, yeah. I think she would never win because of that.
So who's a politician who has integrated humor into his or her shtick?
Well, I guess Mayor Pete, but I hate that name is so whimsical. It hardly inspires power.
Mayor Pete?
Yeah, yeah. And,
we had him on the show a few weeks ago.
But, you know, I don't think any of them have the power to win. They're all going to argue about with each other, should the Boston bomber be allowed to vote? Oh, come on. Let's get over these kind of arguments. They're going to have to attack each other.
Yeah.
And before to see who gets it, which is going to ruin it.
Well, you know, it's an interesting cultural moment because, as you said at the beginning of the book, you're now practically respectable. And you certainly weren't, you know, 40 years ago. And yet at the same time, we have a lot of rollbacks on laws. We just have all this, you know, rollback on abortion legislation is still not enacted, but it's scary. So it's kind of a yin yang.
Yeah,
thing.
And now we have someone. The president used to be respected, you know, used to be the most respectful person. But I get why his fans like him. We hate him, and they love that. And also, he's doing exactly what he said he was going to do.
Yeah. So, by the way, before you get off the satanic cult thing, what about that Lucian Greer?
I love him. He's my friend.
He's Lucian, kind of scary, isn't he?
Oh, I think he's a smart, really intelligent man that is my friend.
Yeah.
And also, I think he defines his church and talks about it in a very level-headed, intelligent way. And he fights radical Christians. He fights the satanic panic, which still people are in jail. The McMartin case started that. They were innocent, you know. They all got off. People forget that. So
that was the multiple personality disorder with the children in the daycare centers.
I think he's a great warrior.
Yeah, and his whole thing is separating the government from
which
religion.
Which I believe in. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, none of this church and state where you can have the Ten Commandments. Of course, they use humor. When they allowed Bible school back in the public school, he sued them once so they could have satanic Bible school, and some people signed up. And they had a coloring book and everything. It's hilarious.
We're talking to John Waters. The book, again, is Mr. Know-It-All. You know, I thought of you the other day, actually. It was actually about a month ago. When did your film Pecker come out?
Oh, let me think.
Late 1990s?
Sometime around that.
You saw the headline. Was it the New York Post?
Yeah.
Bezos exposes Pecker. Well, I mean, how can you not think of John Waters in a moment like that?
The other one more they do, Left Hanging. They always do all the, what's the one, the texting one?
Anthony Weiner.
I felt bad for him because
Do you know him?
No, I don't know him, but no writer I know would ever not read the New York Post every day.
Yeah.
It's I mean, a riot. Come on.
What's your favorite headline ever from the New York Post?
Mine is, I'll tell you mine, the meanest one.
Yeah.
When Ike Turner died. Ike beats Tina to death.
I have said that on the air. That is one of my, but what's your favorite one? That's one of
well,
the best ones ever.
Well, it's one everyone says, headless body, topless bar.
Yeah, my friend good. Even made a movie called that. Peter Fuller made a movie called Hitting That, too.
Yeah,
so,
that,
yeah,
was
that was
a great
good one, too. Yeah, yeah.
So what do you think about the shark situation down in Provincetown?
I know you go to Long Nook, too,
I go
right?
to Long Nook. I love it. It makes it more edgy, our beach. Every day, I think, maybe we'll get bitten. That's even more exciting, I think.
But you don't go in the water, do you?
I go in the water 3 days after it happened. And when I went in the second day after it happened, I didn't go in, but a father was throwing his son up in the air and catching him. And I thought, well, that's like, hey, come and get it. But I know abortion's illegal, but that's like really pushing it. So I just thought it was amazing. So I still, that is where, and I was away when it happened. And I saw on the CBS News them walking up that hill carrying a body. I thought, oh, my God.
This is where the guy actually was killed.
Yeah.
Long Nook is this great beach in Truro, by
the
way.
No, I think the one was killed down the beach. They bit his leg off at Long Nook.
Okay.
I think, for me, it just adds more edge to Provincetown.
So did you hear the controversy at the Christmas tree shops? You may have been out of town for this one.
No, what?
They were selling towels with a big picture of a shark. And underneath it said, the better to eat you with, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And people thought, too soon. Too soon.
They turn them off the shelves.
Too soon.
They're worried about it because of the seals. You know, they come right up next to you when you're swimming. So, I think there will be people that will be afraid to go to the beach.
Yeah.
I don't know what we're going to do about it. It's nature. And, you know, it's still the tiniest risk ever of
getting bitten. Yeah, closer to shore. That's
shark.
How I feel. Closer to shore.
I'd rather be bitten by a shark than killed on Route 6 driving home.
Well, that's a big problem because that is, even with those things in the middle.
Route 6 is the killer highway.
It's a bad highway.
Because people slow down to go to a jelly stand where there's an entrance off a 60-mile-an-hour road.
Love the jelly stands, actually.
But remember before they had the barriers between people who would pass? It was like, oh, my God. What do they call it? Suicide Alley or something like that?
Can we get back to a sore subject? So does this mean you're not going to make another film?
Well, I would if they come along with it, but I bet I won't, actually. You know, I've already signed another deal for a book. I'm in the middle of writing that. I have the spoken word show. I host a John Waters camp in Connecticut every year. I host a big punk rock festival called Burger Boogaloo in Oakland every year. So
yeah, that's enough.
I don't know when I'd make it if they said yes.
Yeah, you don't want to have to be working yourself to the bone your entire life, do you, Jim?
What are you, like his job counselor
I'm just
or something?
About it.
He can make his own
I was
decision.
Writing books and making money and spending Memorial Day to Labor Day and down the Cape and doing all these other things, I say the heck with it.
Yeah, but if it comes along, I still have meetings about it. I had a meeting last week about making Fruitcake, a children's Christmas movie that I got paid. We never made it, though.
So tell us about Disgraceland.
Well, that's where I'm going to be buried. That's where, in the same graveyard where Divine was. And Mink Stole, me, Pat Moran, Dennis Dermy, all my friends, we all bought graves there.
Did you
so
really?
We call it Disgraceland. Yeah, yeah. And so, it's you know, not many people get buried with their friends. It's a new concept in death.
Does anybody?
I don't know anybody either. But then other people have told me that yes, and they've named some people that did that I didn't know about. But it is rare.
Why does it matter at that point?
It matters to me because
I know
of
why.
The people that come visit
exactly.
your grave, they can do three in one shopping.
Kill a lot of birds with one stone. Exactly.
Yeah, it's environmentally correct. They don't have to spend
good.
Gas the whole time.
Exactly.
I think it's
a great
graveyards.
Idea. Think about it. We should have the radio talk show host little plot.
Oh, that'd
Jim.
Be great. Yeah. I'll tell you. No, some of our colleagues I'd love to be buried near, actually.
Well, I suppose that's a good point. You probably wouldn't.
John, your book is great. Yet another one. It's great to see
you. Thank you very much.
How long did it take you to do this?
3 years it took me to write this book, from beginning to end.
That's pretty
fast. Because it was a lot of research. You know,
it's a lot of research. It was pretty fast. It's really fun.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Okay, we are done. You can catch John Waters tonight. Oh, I want to tell you the name of the book again. It's called Mr. Know-It-All, The Tarnished Wisdom of a Filth Elder, Past Memoir, Past Tell-All, Full of Insight, Irreverence, and Waters' Advice. You can catch John Waters tonight at 7 o'clock at the First Parish Church in Harvard Square, an event sponsored by the Harvard Bookstore. To get tickets, you go to harvard.com. John Waters, great fun to talk to you, as always, and you've written another great fun book. We are done with Boston Public Radio. You can always catch us by way of our podcast on iTunes. Tomorrow we're going to be at the Boston Public Library Studio. Sports reporter Trenny Kuznarek will be there. CNN's John King will talk to him. Historian David McCullough will be there as well. And the president of the Boston City Council, Andrea Campbell. We want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, our engineer, John Claw Parker. What is on television, Jim Browdy?
Well, the mayor of the city of Boston is going to join me tonight, Marty Walsh. Christina Quinn has a piece on schools teaching porn literacy. Actually, John could be doing that. And speaking of John,
exactly.
Even though he's going to be on television with me tonight, we're pre-taping it, so you can go check him out at the church and then go home and watch him on television. And I'm going to do a little commentary about the show that I never saw, Game of Thrones. That's it.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow. Have a great afternoon.